Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff this week on the show. It's a Pokemon party. Pokemon Detective Pikachu. It's out in Japan. I've been trying to get my brother to go see it because I think that would be funny because he's in Japan. But we haven't seen it yet because it's not out in America till next week. So in the meantime, we went back to our 6 and 7 year old selves and watched Pokemon, the first movie from 1999 in its American release. And we're going to talk about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're going to review the very first Pokemon movie. It is also that film's 20th anniversary. That film is also getting a CGI remake in Japan. So there's a lot of reasons to talk about Pokemon the first movie right now. But we're going to do that. We are also going to talk about that insane Sonic the Hedgehog trailer.
Yeah, there's just a lot. Ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sonic the Hedgehog. You know, it seems like there is some sort of deal with the devil made to get fucking the Detective Pikachu movie made, because early reports are from people who like Pokemon stuff say that the Detective Pikachu movie sounds pretty good. Sonic the Hedgehog movie does not look very good at all.
Nah, we'll talk about all that. We'll talk about some other stuff. I might even rant about Game of Thrones. We'll see what happens. This is going to be a fun episode. The Detective Pikachu reviews, Sean, I have to say, are so much fun for me to look at, because it's like split right down the middle. People who know what Pokemon is like it. Like, that's just generally the reaction. And then you have old, crusty, white dude critics at, like, the New York Times or Variety or something being like, man, I don't know what a Jigglypuff is, and I hated this. And it's like, who do you think this is for? Why are you reviewing this movie? That's one of those things that baffles me. It's also like when critics would get up in arms about, like, the last Twilight movie or something. And it's like, what are you there for? Why? What are you doing with your life? Like, you don't have to do this. Anyway, I just think it's funny. I am looking forward to it. I just want to release everyone who doesn't like or know what Pokemon is, you don't have to watch it.
Yeah, and it is like, it was very fun to see just like the very bad Pokemon-based puns that came out of those reviews that are just like, I don't think I realized that review writing style was still a thing that people did, because I just don't pay attention to it.
Yeah.
And so then it's when this happens and I see like some of the dumb quotes like sort of percolate through Twitter. And it's like, oh, okay, yeah. There are like newspaper movie critics that still do that thing of trying to take down a movie that they know nothing about, but they were first to go see. So they just like take some like the easiest top level pun and make it like the deck of their review. That's still a thing that happens. Cool.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll talk about Detective Pikachu next week. For now, like I said, we're going to do some Pokemon. We're going to do some other stuff. Sean, what have you been up to in the last week? Anything to tell us about?
A couple of things. So the first thing I want to talk about, because I have two video game related things. The first one is I have, hot off of my playthrough of Modern Warfare Remastered, I decided to replay the most underrated game of 2016, Call of Duty Infinite Warfare. So I played through that whole campaign. That was more something I actually did the week we did Endgame, but I didn't want to bring it up on that podcast because we had enough shit to talk about on that podcast.
We did.
To not bring up this. But yeah, so I played through Infinite Warfare. That game is still fucking awesome. People who have not played that campaign, you should play that campaign because it's still very good. But also, I played it on the Specialist difficulty. So that game has the normal set of difficulty modes that every Call of Duty game has, like regular, hardened, veteran, etc. The first time I played it through, I played it on hardened. But when you play through the game once, you unlock an extra difficulty mode that's called specialist mode. And I had always heard that there are people that said that, like, oh, this game is really awesome if you play it on that mode. And it had been like sitting in the back of my mind since that game came out that I wanted to go back and play it. But I didn't know what the details of what that mode actually meant. I just thought it was like it's like a really difficult mode that like kind of changes the way you play the game a bit. But it's a lot more elaborate than that. So the thing that it says when you select specialist mode is it basically just says like basically veteran difficulty, but with additional resource management elements or something like that, which made it sound to me like, you probably have less ammo and that kind of shit. And what they actually mean is, It's sort of a soft simulation-y kind of mode where you don't have recharging health anymore. Instead, they have added in items called nano shots that are basically health packs that you have to use to regenerate your health. They have also added in helmets so that if you are playing on a level that's on like an asteroid or in space and you get the shot in the head enough that your helmet breaks, you just die instantly because you're in space and you need to be able to breathe. So they added helmets. Also, that's all. If your helmet gets destroyed and you don't have a replacement helmet, your HUD is just completely gone. But the biggest change they did is that they added in basically positional specific damage for your character, so that if you get shot, like say in the right arm enough, your right arm breaks and you cannot aim down sights and your reloading is really slow. Or if you get shot in the legs a lot, you just sort of like fall to the ground and they never make it so that you can't stand up. They don't go that far because that would just break some of the level design, but like you move much slower and your aim sways a lot and you like hit the ground when it first hits you. And if that happens, the only way you can fix that is by using one of those health pack consumables. And so they really added this whole completely like very different way of playing the game and having to manage like how you're dealing with the damage you're taking and how you make choices of how you're going to use the resources available to you. And it's a really, really fucking cool way to play through that game, especially if you, again, since you, it's basically a new game plus mode, that means that you go in with all the upgrades and weapon unlocks you got the first time you played through the game. So if you go through and you try to play it on one of the normal difficulties, again, your character is very, very powerful early on. But if you play it on specialist, that difficulty feels like it's tuned that you are supposed to have access to every single weapon at the beginning of the game, because it is brutally difficult if you don't. So yeah, it's just a really, really awesome way to change up the way that game works in a way that utterly surprised me.
A normal Call of Duty thing? Do they generally have that?
Not as far as I know. It's not...
Okay, wow.
I don't know if any of the games post-Infinite Warfare, like Black Ops... Well, Black Ops 4 doesn't even have a campaign, but I know if, like... I know Call of Duty World War II doesn't have regenerating health in the campaign, so I don't know if it took some stuff from that mode and carried it on or not. But as far as I know, this is the only game that has that specific mode type. And it's really cool. So I would recommend if people want... Like, have played through that campaign and want to go back and check it out again and replay it, now that we're, you know, nearing the end of this console life cycle or whatever, people maybe are, like I am, kind of feeling like I want to play through again and check out some of the games from this generation. Like, I think you should, like, try that specialist mode, because it really changes up the way you think about how you play a Call of Duty game and makes it something very different.
That's so cool. I've never heard of a game doing that with a difficult... Like, the hard modes just don't do that. Like, that's rewriting a lot of the basic gameplay. Infinite Warfare, man, you said most underrated of 2016. It's the most underrated of this generation. Like, mm-hmm. that game deserves so much more respect than it got. And I'm just, you know, we'll see what Infinity Ward has this year for Call of Duty. I'm definitely interested because they're very good at what they do. But I suspect they will not get to follow up this game, and that makes me sad.
Yeah, no, because especially just playing through it again reminded me of all the awesome shit of like all the guns in the game are really interesting and different, and they have cool alternate fire modes, like and then in the campaign you unlock different things that change the guns up even more. So there's like one gun that is a submachine gun that has an alternate firing mode that makes it a shotgun, but you can bring in an unlock on that gun that makes it so that instead of it being a submachine gun, it's just a shotgun, but instead of it being like a big sort of spread, the shots fire in like a straight line, and then the alternate fire mode switches on whether it's a vertical line or a horizontal line. And I played through a whole mission basically using that gun that way it's the mission on the asteroid where all the robots come and attack you, and it's basically only robot enemies in that mission, and that shotgun chews through those things, and it's just like, I kind of want to play through it again, just choosing different weapons and different equipment loadouts, because that game is so... Because it's set in the future and it just gets to have space tech, it's so liberated from the, like, here's my 3-round burst assault rifle, here's my full auto assault rifle, here's my submachine gun, and here's my sniper rifle, here's my LMG, and that's the only weapons in, you know, a Call of Duty game. Instead, there's real differentiation within the weapon classes, way more so than any other Call of Duty game can have, because it's not restricted to actual, like, military weaponry.
That's cool. Now I want to play that game again.
Yes, it's very good. And you can play through it very quickly. Like, even on specialist mode, I think it only took me about 8 to 9 hours to play through the game, and I played through all the side missions and stuff. So it's a quick... Because I think I played through it in basically 2 sittings my first time through. So even on that harder difficulty, it is a quick playthrough. So again, people can just go back to that, knock that out over a weekend. It's awesome, and that game should be celebrated more than it is.
Absolutely. I have been spending the last week and a half, Sean, playing digging games.
Okay.
Yes.
That's the interesting sentence.
What do I mean by this? There's a bit of a story to it. So last week, there was a game that came out on Switch called A SteamWorld Quest, Hand of Gilgamesh, and it got a bunch of really good reviews and sounded really cool. If you don't know what the SteamWorld series is, it's by a European developer named Image Inform, and all the games they make are under the banner SteamWorld, and they all have these like little robot creatures who run on steam, so they like water is like their oil. And other than that, though, all the different SteamWorld games, they're like different genres, they're different styles, they've done a lot of cool experimentation with them. The most famous ones are SteamWorld Dig and SteamWorld Dig 2. Dig 2 got a lot of acclaim back in 2017 when it came out. But they've also made one, the first one ever was a tower defense game on the Nintendo DSi. They had a SteamWorld Heist game, which is like some kind of strategic RPG sort of thing. And SteamWorld Quest, which was really acclaimed last week, is a card battle game. So it's like you have a deck of cards and you make that and you do card battles with them, which sounds... I love that kind of thing. And that game got really good reviews and I'm like, I really want to play this SteamWorld Quest game. It looks really cool. And then I looked at my bank account and it was near the end of the month and I had no money. So I could not buy SteamWorld Quest. I'm like, okay, I'm going to be responsible. I'm not going to buy a game when I have no money. So I looked through my Switch because I was wanting to play something new. I've probably put like 20 hours into Super Dragon Ball Heroes, and I think I need to take a step back from that game. So, you know, I've been looking for other things to play, and I realized I had totally forgotten this. I had SteamWorld Dig 1 on my Switch. There was a sale a couple months ago, and they had that game for like a dollar. Like, I bought it with like gold points. I don't think I even spent any money on it. So I got that game. And I just, one night, I opened it up to just see, like, you know, I'm kind of interested in playing the SteamWorld Quest game. What's this one like? And 3, like, hours later, at, like, 2 in the morning, I'm like, oh my god, I love this. So SteamWorld Dig and then its sequel, SteamWorld Dig 2, are both Metroidvania-style games, but they are also digging games. Kind of like the classic arcade game Dig Dug is one of the, like, points of comparison people make. But basically, you are a cool little robot in SteamWorld Dig 1. You are a robot named Rusty. In Dig 2, you are a robot named Dorothy, Rusty's friend. And you basically have this mine. And in Dig 1, it's very simple. It's just you keep going down, and you're going down into the earth. And every block in the game is breakable. You have to, like, upgrade your pickaxe, and you upgrade other things. It's very much like a Metroid game, where as you go through the world, you get more and more upgrades, and they allow you to go on different paths and do different things. But you also... And this is what makes it so addictive, is as you're digging, you get all of these resource tiles, which is where you break and you get, like, an emerald or a ruby or something like that. And you can go sell that for money and upgrade your town. And the more you upgrade your town, the more you get upgrades that you can go use in the digging. And I love this kind of game. I love Metroid-style things just in general. The digging stuff is very much in, like, the Minecraft realm of, like, this is very addictive to just dig and explore and get stuff. And I also love games with lots of upgrades. So this game was my shit. I loved it. SteamWorld Dig, just really, really good. And I finished it. It's only like 6 hours long. And I was like, god damn it. It's still not May. I don't have my next paycheck. And I want to play more. SteamWorld Dig 2 is cheaper than SteamWorld Quest. So fuck it. I'm buying SteamWorld Dig 2. And I have played the shit out of that game, Sean. I 100%ed everything in SteamWorld Dig 2. It took me like 12, 13 hours. And the only thing I have left is once you 100% everything, it opens up an extra challenge cave, which I'm still trying to get through because it's very hard. But I played the absolute shit out of that. SteamWorld Dig 1 is good and I recommend it. I think you should play it first just because it's fun, and SteamWorld Dig 2 would kind of ruin it for you. But SteamWorld Dig 2 is like one of those games where it's like, the first game was good, and then the second is like a meteoric leap in quality. I love when games do that, and it is just, it's so fantastic. I love everything about it. It's even more Metroid-esque because it's a much bigger world. It's not just digging down, but there's areas all over the place. There's a lot more backtracking is the wrong term, but like re-exploring areas that you couldn't get to before. It just, the games play so smooth and well. Like, you have this wall jump you do, and that wall jump is so fucking addictive. In Dig 2, you also get some cool stuff. Like, you get a little jetpack, and you get a grappling hook, and like just grappling up and to the side and everything in these caves that you go through is so fun. And then Dig 2 also adds all of these challenge caves, which you do to basically get your upgrade cogs, which they change the whole upgrade system. And those challenge caves are just, they're so great. They're basically taking the main mechanics of the game and putting you through a series of cool different trials and puzzles and all of that kind of stuff I love. And just these two games, so made for me. All I want on Earth right now is SteamWorld Dig 3, and Dig 2 very much ends. Cliffhanger. We're waiting for Dig 3. There's more story to come, so I'm sure they're making it, but I really want to play it. I did get paid because it got to May 1st, so I have bought SteamWorld Quest, but I have not had time to start it yet, but I am excited to do that and continue my adventures in SteamWorld. But at the same time, I also heard about another digging game that just came out last week on the Switch. It's an indie game. I think it's also on iOS, and I think it's on Xbox as well. It's not on PS4, but it's called Dig Dog, so kind of a takeoff on Dig Dug, but it's called Dig Dog. This is also a digging game. This is not a Metroidvania. It's a roguelike, where you have these levels that are, you know, procedurally generated, and you're a dog, and you have to dig around. It's all 2D, and there's enemies and stuff, and you have to find a bone in every level. And when you find the bone, you move on to the next level, and it gets harder as you go along, and you see how long you can survive. It's basically like a little mobile game or something. It is also surprisingly addictive, and again, I think I just have now a love for games that let me dig into things. I don't know why, but I have spent the last week playing digging games. Dig Dog is very fun as well. It's only $3 on Switch, so I assume it's that much on iOS or something. It's a great kind of game where if you just want to like kill 10 minutes, go play that. And I also wanted to mention Dig Dog because the way I heard about it is the developer put out a video. It's a solo developer. His video is really cool. He talks about the game. He also is someone who has some kind of neurological disability that prevents him from using his hands for fine motor functions, and so he can't use a mouse and keyboard to program. So this video shows how he made this entire game from scratch on his own without using his hands, like using a microphone to do coding, and like using this thing where he rigged like his hat and a camera so he could use the tip of the hat to like move his head and draw. I thought all of that was really cool. It's a really cool game and worthwhile without knowing that, but that's just like, I couldn't make a game this fun at all. So, you know, and I have full use of my hands. So that was really cool. I liked Dig Dog. I liked SteamWorld Dig 2. I liked SteamWorld Dig 1. I want more digging games.
You know, digging, it's a time-honored game mechanic in the history of video games. Some of the earliest video games have lots of digging in it. Modern video games, you know, Minecraft. Minecraft is maybe like the greatest digging game of all digging games that could ever be made.
My most anticipated new game of this year, if I'm being purely honest in my heart of hearts, is probably Dragon Quest Builders 2. So there you go.
Lots of digging in that.
Oh yeah.
That sounds fun. I have also been playing another video game. It's not a digging game. In fact, it's absolutely nothing to do with digging. But it is an older video game. I've been playing, and I'm only pretty early on, but I've been playing Mafia 3.
Oh, nice.
Yes, which is a game that was on PS Plus a while ago. It's not a recent PS Plus game, but it's, you know, it was a PS Plus game from several months, of maybe about a year ago. The game originally came out, let's see if I can remember, 2016, October 2016. And I've been always kind of like, I've heard there are lots of people that really, really like Mafia 3, and so I've always been curious about it. And ever since it went on PS Plus, I was like, I should probably play this game. And it's one of the nice things about this year being pretty slow in terms of video game releases in general, and particularly video game releases like that I am interested in, has allowed me to do this stuff where I can just play through fucking Call of Duty and now dip my toes into Mafia 3 so that I can actually take a break and play old video games. But so for people who don't know, Mafia 3 is a sort of Grand Theft Auto style open world crime game, which is one of the fun things about playing it, is it's been a while since people made another one of those. Not counting something like Red Dead that's like Old West, like this is relatively modern times open world crime game. But it's not quite modern times because it's set in 1968, You play as Lincoln Clay, who's an African American veteran of the Vietnam War. He was in the Special Forces. At the very beginning of the game, he's just gotten back from the war. He's in New Bordeaux, which is basically their like fake version of New Orleans, which is basically just New Orleans. I honestly don't know why it's a fake city name, because it makes the game feel like weirdly outdated, because I feel like video games don't do that as much anymore. But yeah, so it's New Bordeaux instead of New Orleans, and it's where he grew up, and he's come back here. And when he was living in New Bordeaux before he left to join the military for the Vietnam War, he was a member of the Black Mafia in that city, working with, they were like, you know, a small subsidiary working with the Italian mob that oversees the criminal operations in the city. He's left, came back, and when he's come back, there's a lot of trouble between his sort of like adoptive father, Sonny, I think his name is, who's the head of the Black Mob, who's having a lot of friction with the Italian mob, and Lincoln Clay comes back right when that's kind of hitting a zenith, and he gets involved in that. In sort of the very beginning of the game, he starts a job working for the Italian mob to kind of try to clear the slate for the Black Mob, but then they betray him, and they shoot him in the head, and he enters a coma, and then over the course of like several months, he recovers, and he decides, okay, fuck these guys, I'm going to take over this city and kill everyone, last one of these Italian mob motherfuckers. And that's basically the setup of the game, is like this grand mob revenge story set against late 60s America, with a lot of like racial politics and stuff like front and center. Like, they're not hiding from the racism stuff. It's very clearly like, we are interested in tackling the topic of race during this period in America, and doing that in the vein of this sort of like, not quite blaxploitation, but like edging up against kind of blaxploitation territory in terms of the genre and the style of it. And all of that stuff in the game is fucking awesome. Like, just all of the sort of story setup, the cinematics, the style, the music, because there's tons and tons and tons and tons of licensed music, lots of like Creedence Clearwater and that kind of stuff from that period. You know, they play Paint It Black during a pivotal cutscene because you have to. Fortunate Son plays on the radio when you come up. Like, it's, you know, it's that kind of style. But it also has a cool framing device for all the sort of exposition, which is, it is framed as a modern day documentary investigating the events of all this shit happening in New Bordeaux. So you occasionally get like in a cutscene, like a cut to this character who's like the priest that knows Lincoln, but now he's like 30 years older and it's an interview and he's sort of talking about the events as they happened in the past. And that stuff can be a little bit clunky in terms of some of the dialogue is maybe a little bit too set up-y for like a, oh, and this is then when this big thing happened, in a way that doesn't feel totally natural for a documentary, but it is a very clever device to get some of like the character exposition and backstory across. And basically that whole story narrative side of the game is filled with a lot of style, and I can definitely see immediately why so many people were saying that like people should pay more attention to what Mafia 3 was doing, because it is very fucking cool.
That's awesome. I love everything you're saying. I think you and I, another game we probably both have in mind right now is Sleeping Dogs, because I love open world crime city games that are not Grand Theft Auto. Like when someone does it, but they don't do Grand Theft Auto, it's so cool. And it feels like to differentiate yourselves from Grand Theft Auto, you have to like do something big. Sleeping Dogs did something big. Sounds like Mafia 3 is doing something very big and cool there. I'm sold. Yes. That sounds great.
Yeah, Sleeping Dogs is a really good comparison point, because like with Sleeping Dogs is like, what if it was sort of Grand Theft Auto but a Hong Kong action movie? This is that, like, what if it's Grand Theft Auto but it's this like very gritty sort of post-Vietnam War pseudo-blaxploitation crime like revenge story. And so all the gameplay side of it is really kind of brutal, but it's stylized in a really good way where like the guns have a lot of impact to them. They do a fun thing where like when you shoot a guy, a lot of they'll like sort of stumble back and follow. There's like a lot of good animation that blended with ragdoll physics in terms of when you take out enemies and they'll like sort of fall backwards over banisters and collapse onto tables and stuff. And it feels like it's definitely very programmed to have these cool little kind of movie gunshot reactions happen, but it definitely feels like when you like walk into a joint and you just shoot it the fuck up and guys are like flying backwards over seats and stuff, it's very fun, and it definitely sort of indulges in the power fantasy. That's a big part of the sort of narrative it's engaging in. But the best part of the gameplay so far for me, and again, I'm very early on. Like, I've just kind of started doing some of the more open world stuff. So I'm kind of out of the beginning tutorial stuff as it's sort of taking the wheels off. So I don't know what the later game will be like. But early on, I would highly recommend, if people are interested in checking this game out, that you turn on the simulation style driving model, because the game actually gives you two different driving models you can use. There's an arcadey one, and then there's a simulation one. And the arcadey one is very snappy and sort of what you'd normally expect from like a Grand Theft Auto 5-esque driving model. But the simulation one is so much more fun because the cars feel so weighty and you're driving, you know, these like late 60s fucking like muscle cars. And there's something about the like driving really fast towards an intersection, slamming on like they're like pulling back the handbrake and the back of the car just kicks the fuck out and the wheels are spinning in the air and then they land and like kick up all this dust. And when you're playing on the arcade racing model, the cars just are very light and turn very easily. On that simulation model, like, you really have to pay attention to when you're braking and like, how you, when you're starting your turn and stuff. Because if you don't, you're just going to spin the fuck out. But it makes the cars feel so weighty and just, like, have all this momentum behind them. And it's probably the most fun I've had with a driving model in any of these kinds of games. And Sleeping Dogs actually had something a little bit more similar, where the driving in that game was a bit more technical as well compared to like a Grand Theft Auto. But Mafia 3, there's something with like how it combines with the setting that you're driving these big fuck off old cars that are just huge and like just have this like big engine sound, and it's got, again, that kind of power fantasy of like that this is a mean fucking vehicle that you're driving. And especially when you in some of the prologue stuff, you Lincoln gets his old muscle car that he left behind. That's like this car that he loves, and he tuned it up and all this stuff. And when you start driving that, like, it just feels so powerful and so much fun. And they also have a really awesome sort of navigation model where instead of it just being sort of like the GPS, like here's like a line that you're following thing, at street corners there will be this sort of like digital sort of like they kind of make it look a little bit like it's a street sign that will just have an arrow, so it'll be like pointing straight if you're supposed to go straight, or left if you're supposed to turn around, or turn left, right if you're supposed to turn right. So you don't ever have to look at the mini map to figure out where you're going, and you also don't have this very sort of immersion breaking here's just a big line in the world that you're driving and following behind. Instead, it's a much more natural, you can see up ahead, oh, I'm gonna have to take a right turn at that intersection like three stops down. So you can kind of plan ahead that way. And it's a very immersive way to present that information that keeps a lot of junk off the screen and allows you to actually pay attention to where you're going and appreciating the very beautiful recreation of New Orleans they've made. So it's a very slick game and it's a lot of fun. And I know that the reviews at the time were a little more mixed because it sounds like the game, the open world stuff maybe gets more repetitive later on. But one of the nice things about playing this game when it's a PS Plus game, like 4 years or 3 years after it came out, is I have no need to have to finish this game. So if it ever gets repetitive, I'll just stop playing it. But right now, like 6 hours in, sort of starting to get into the open world and doing some like kind of district takeover stuff, I'm kind of taking over the sort of like this starting area, and they kind of have you to kind of feed you where you're supposed to go and what activities you're supposed to do. While doing that, I'm still having a lot of fun with it. So if people have that game from PS Plus, it's definitely worth checking out, at least for like the bonkers fucking like first 3 to 4 hours that are very like cinematic, like setting up the story, setting up the revenge element of it. All that shit's so fucking cool that people should at least play that part, if nothing else.
That sounds awesome. I was just checking my PlayStation account to see if I had PlayStation Plus around the time this was on there, and I did not. So I do not have it.
So unfortunately.
That's too bad. I re-upped my PlayStation Plus like earlier this year because I was playing so much Destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And there has been zero good PlayStation Plus games since I re-upped. I mean, I think they had some that were okay, but I already owned them. So, like, there has not been anything for me yet. But yeah. I'm sure something in the next year will
come out. This month is going to have What Remains of Edith Finch, which is a game I've wanted to play but never got around to buying. That's like a sort of Gone Homey style thing. So that's, yes. I will probably play through that when that's out, because that sounds like it's like a 2 to 3 hour game.
Yeah. Okay. Sean, question.
Yes.
You do not watch Game of Thrones.
No, I do not.
Do you mind if I spoil Game of Thrones?
No, because I already know basically everything you're about to say about Game of Thrones, because it was impossible, both as someone who occasionally uses Twitter and as someone working in a high school where literally every other teacher watches Game of Thrones, to not know every fucking detail about season 8, episode 3, The Long Night. Is that the title of the episode?
It is.
Yeah, I know too much about this. So yes, you can go ahead and talk about this, what sounds like a very interesting episode of this show.
Horrible episode. Okay. We do not talk about Game of Thrones much on here because Sean doesn't watch it and one-sided conversations can be boring. I want to specifically talk about this episode, Sean, because one of the things you and I have a shared interest in is story structure. And I think you are very good at picking apart story structure, and we both enjoy identifying, like, where you can kind of break down if you are trying to tell a good story in a structural sense, right?
Yes, yeah.
Because Game of Thrones, so we are recording this Sunday afternoon, so episode 4, whatever that winds up being, I have not seen it, no one has seen it yet. I know when this is out, you'll have seen it, and maybe it's good and redeems some of this season so far. I'm only talking about episode 3, The Long Night, so skip ahead if you don't like spoilers. There'll be a time chart, whatever. This episode was fucking awful, and it was awful in many different ways. Like, I just think as a production, it got so far away from them. Clearly, the main reason this episode exists is because they were swimming in HBO money. And they're like, how do we spend all this HBO money? It's like they're a fucking college with a really successful basketball team during NCAA. And they have to, like, spend all of the money on a new stadium or else they won't be a nonprofit anymore. And that's bad for them. So they're like, let's just do the bells and whistles and do everything, even if we don't need it. That's what this episode of Game of Thrones was. It did very, very little for story, very, very little for character. It was there to just throw money at the screen. Miguel Sapochnik, who is a really good director, and his other episodes of Game of Thrones I have loved, and I even said he should just do the entire final season because he's such a talented director. I take that back. This episode is awfully directed, and I don't know if it's him or if it's decisions made editorially, which sometimes on TV are not in the hands of the director, but like, There were all the jokes about how the episode was too dark. It was too dark. Like, they went for a style of cinematography that simply cannot be rendered on modern streaming technology or cable broadcasts, where you get all of that macro blocking and smeary blacks and all of that. But more importantly, the episode is just edited utterly incoherently. It's not just, like, fast cuts, but also cuts that are constantly breaking basic geographic rules of film editing. You're moving from one location to another with things in flux in such a way that it doesn't make sense why one thing is happening over here while another thing is happening over here. Like, for instance, I'll give you a good example. There's a scene with Arya in the episode where she is moving through a library, and a bunch of the White Walkers, the zombies, are in the library, and she's having to, like, dodge them. And by a bunch, I mean, like, 15 or 20. Like, it's not a ton of White Walkers, but enough that they're a threat to Arya. And I think the cut before that scene is a wall of Winterfell getting broken down and literally thousands of walkers streaming into the compound. And so, do you see the problem here, Sean, maybe, between those two edits?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to go from, oh my god, like, they're all here now, they've broken in, there's thousands of them, to, oh, we've got to deal with, like, a dozen of them.
Yeah, and it's like, why are they in the library at all? And how, one, how did Arya get out of the battlefield? Why are there only 12 of them here? What the hell is just all of it? Just it's all what the hell is going on. And that's a scene that I bring up because a lot of people are like, that scene was really good. There was so much tension. And I'm like, yes, if you take that episode out of context, or that scene out of context completely, it's a well-made scene. It makes no sense in the context of the episode. So you have a lot of stuff like that. I think it's poorly put together. The one thing I liked about this episode was the music. Ramin Djawadi is a phenomenal composer. He always does phenomenal work. The music in this was phenomenal. But music is not enough to save an episode. The real reason I need to rant about this, Sean, is from this story structure point. And this is why I wanted to bring it up to you. The first scene of Game of Thrones, in the show and in George R. R. Martin's books, is a scene where the Night's Watch encounters for the first time the White Walkers. In the books, they're called the Others. I think they changed it in the TV show because of the Lost connection. In Lost, the bad guys are the Others. They meet the White Walkers, and, like, so this is the initial threat we meet. And throughout the series, there's kind of been two halves of the show. There's many halves to the show, but there's been two dominant kind of storylines, which is the struggle for power in Westeros, just the political struggle between different political players on the map. And then up in the north, and this is usually centered around the character of Jon Snow, who is at the Wall and eventually becomes Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, the struggle against the White Walkers, who are this group of zombies who are amassing an army and heading south, and they're going to try to take over the world or whatever. We never actually learned their motivations because they ended it all in this episode without telling us that. So this is a very big part of the series. And such a big part of the series that the seventh season, so the previous season before now, really gives itself over to the idea that, okay, we have to put aside all of our petty political grievances, we have to all come together, and we have to fight this. It's very much, people have made this joke, but it's a global warming allegory, right? Like, either we all come together and put aside the fights of the day, the transient fights, or else we're not going to survive long enough to even have those battles. I'm really not sure what the moral of the story is under that allegorical framework if, in episode 3, we beat the White Walkers entirely in 1 hour. It was an 80-minute episode, so 80 minutes. None of our main characters died, except Jorah and Theon. Theon doesn't really count, because who the fuck cares? And Jorah, like, they had telegraphed his death every episode for, like, 3 seasons now. Other than that, no main characters died. They had spent 2 full episodes in season 8. The first 2 are completely committed to just set up of, like, all these characters are really afraid they're going to die. And, like, the second episode of season 8 is, like, half of the episode is, like, you get these 8 characters around a fireplace, and they all assume it's their last night on Earth, and they have this kind of long night of the soul. Every single one of those characters lived. And then eventually Arya just stabbed the Night King, the leader of the White Walkers, with the little dagger, and he blew up, and then all the zombies blew up, and it was over. And I just gotta say, that was a very, very easy, relatively painless wrap-up to, like, what half of this series was, and it's the kind of awful storytelling, and I can get into it more in a little bit, that retroactively makes me dislike so much of this series because it was leading nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting to me as an outsider hearing, because, my parents watch Game of Thrones. In fact, people maybe have heard on this podcast a couple of, like, episodes ago, the Game of Thrones theme playing in the background because my parents started watching the episode while we were recording the podcast. They watch it as soon as it goes up. Then, like I said, all the teachers at the high school I'm at, they all watch Game of Thrones, and they've all been talking about this episode. And so it's interesting from the outside, then all throughout, you know, it's just such a thing you hear about Game of Thrones all the time, hearing about how anticlimactic this sounds of this thing of, like, oh, I've known that that's been one of the main things the whole time. I've always heard about, oh, there are, like, these zombies or some supernatural force everybody has to come together to defeat, that's kind of like the inciting incident or whatever of the whole series, is the arrival of these supernatural creatures. And then it seems like after that, it sounds like it becomes much more about the, like, political intrigue thing in the middle part, right? Is that true that takes, like, way more precedence over the zombie stuff?
The zombies, yeah. So the zombies really don't become super prominent in the show until season 5. They're in the background mm-hmm. through seasons 1 through 4. And then in season 5, they become more prominent. But other than Jon Snow and his side of the show, most characters don't really become aware until the previous season.
Yeah, because it... And so that structure makes it sound like if they're going for the global warming thing... It seemed to me like Game of Thrones should have ended with, like, all these people fucking dying. And, like, the Night King basically winning. There's some sort of, like, the humans win some sort of Pyrrhic victory. And the Night King doesn't exterminate all of humanity. But everybody you care about has basically died and humanity has to start over. That's been what I've thought for a while sounded like the way that Game of Thrones is going to go. And so it was to, like, find out that... The third episode of this season, which is this, like, 7 episodes long? Because it's a shorter season. 6. So halfway through the last season. So at least it's not, like, 3 of, like, 10 episodes. But halfway through the last season, that gets resolved by Lady Mi from Doctor Who killing the Night King out of nowhere. Like, that does sound weird. Like, it was not something I was expecting to hear about what was happening in Game of Thrones was that. It's just like, oh, okay, I guess that happens.
Yeah, and so I'm also coming at this from the perspective of, I've read the books, I've seen the show. There are 5 books in the series so far. In those 5 books, 5 out of a planned 7 books, the White Walkers are never as big a presence in the books as they are on the show. Like, I don't know where Martin is going with it. I do not think it's going to be quite like the show because it's just not building in the same way. Like I don't know if Jon Snow has ever even encountered one of the White Walkers in the books. Maybe like once or twice, but never like the full army, because I don't think he's at the Fist of the First Men, which is where that happens in the book. But like, and they're sort of more of an ethereal threat. It's very different in the books. In the show, though, I think because as the show's budget has gotten bigger, they've had the ability to do more with it. And it's a, you know, everyone who has the ability to make a cool zombie battle wants to make a cool zombie battle, right?
Sure,
and so
yeah.
I think the show has just, like, ladled it on and made one of the two or three most primary characters, Jon Snow, into, like that is his thing. That is what he deals with. It is the White Walkers for him. And so they've made it so prominent. If they're real, because clearly I think what they've signaled is that they want to end the show on the political intrigue. I have no problem with that in theory because it is the better part of the show. But like, you can't say that's where I want to end and then give every indication for 7.5 seasons that that's not where you're going to end. You know what I mean? Like, that's the problem in planting and payoff. If it sounds like I just have bloodlust complaining about them not killing enough characters, it's twofold. It's one is just from a basic storytelling standpoint, you cannot do the thing where you do two full episodes, two full hours of setup that is completely about the idea that characters are going to die and then not kill any of those characters you hint are going to die, right? Like, that's just basic storytelling 101.
Yes,
and then also, like, look, every story ever told has some characters with plot armor. The idea that, like, you're not going to kill this character ever, or at least until the very end, right? The trick then, like, every story has that. In Harry Potter, Harry, if he's going to die, it's not going to be until the very end. In Breaking Bad, Walter White is going to beat Gus Fring because you can't do Breaking Bad without Walter White. Walter White dies at the very end, but he can't die before then because Bryan Cranston is the face of the show, right?
Yes, the show would be over as soon as that character dies.
Yes.
That's how most, like, plots only can exist as long as there are characters that can enact the plot, and there is no show that is immune to that effect. Like, the only show that is immune is a truly anthology show where characters do not return, and therefore the plot is not dependent upon returning characters. But almost every single story ever told hinges upon at least a handful of characters, and should those characters perish, the plot can no longer continue.
Exactly. And Game of Thrones is not immune to this either, and I have no problem with that in theory. The problem is that if you're going to have characters with plot armor, which as every story has, you cannot then put them in an impossible situation where they literally could not survive by the rules of this universe and keep going on. That's the issue, right? Like,
yeah, and you can't also, because like so much of the conversation about Game of Thrones forever, again, as someone who has not watched the show but absorbed information about the show from like people I know and like the cult and through cultural osmosis, the number one thing you hear about Game of Thrones, and not as much recently because they just killed so many people they couldn't afford to kill people anymore, but through like the middle stretches from like seasons 1 through 5 or whatever, when there is still on the books, the number one thing you heard about all the time was they kill people all the time and there's a lot of sex. And that's like the most things you heard about that, and like people like it, like just in general. And it's just like, it's a well-made show. Outside of just like a people like it, it's all about like, oh, there's all these surprising deaths, and you know they killed Sean Bean in the first season, even though it, like, you know, it's supposed to be surprising because it seems like it's Sean Bean, he's probably the main character. That dude was Boromir, he's cool. Even though he dies and everything, maybe he would die in season one of a big show if you don't know the books or something. And then you hear about, well, I don't know the names of any of the characters, I know there's a thing called the Red Wedding where a lot of people die. It's like, it's a thing you hear about the show all the time, and you can't and like give the audience like shocking death after shocking death after shocking death and sort of build up this sort of, you know, Roman gladiatorial arena thing of like people are just like wanting that sort of shocking death and the emotional effect of that, because if it's executed well, it's a really powerful thing to put into story. If you get the audience to expect that all the time and then you stop doing it, I think people are going to be frustrated, especially when you hit the point in the story where normal things that aren't Game of Thrones, that don't kill off characters all the time, would start killing people off in a sequence that it seems like was you're like almost at the end of the whole show. You have now the space to kill off a bunch of people because you can start pruning down to who are the truly handful of essential characters for the remaining handful of episodes. Everybody else should be disposable at this point.
Yeah, it's... So I agree with all of that, although, again, there's a thing where, like, the books are so much better at this because Martin... The way he narrates the books is through a series of POV characters, and he's very good at indicating... Like, generally, if you're a POV character, you have plot armor because you're doing the POV. There have been, like, two major POV characters who die, and it's very interesting how he handles that. But other than that, like, the deaths are shocking in the books, but in a different... Like, the subversion happens in a different way. The show, like, really upped the ante on that and, like, put it all towards the center. But then, as soon as they went off books, they stopped killing characters. Like, Benioff and Weiss do not have the guts for letting characters go that Martin did. And so there have just been... This has been a problem through seasons 5, 6, 7, and now 8, since they went off book, which is that they keep putting characters in impossible situations and just relying on their plot armor to keep them through it, and it gets frustrating for that reason. Like, this... And this is why I'm getting back to episode 3, is episode 3, this episode, The Long Night, the way it is shot... and put together, and the way they build up the threat, it is like they took all of the characters, strapped them to a nuclear bomb, set the nuclear bomb off, and then they all lived inexplicably. And that's what's frustrating. Like, I've described this to a couple of people who have seen the episode, and they all agree, this is like, I'm right on this, is that the way this episode works is you, first off, this episode starts with all of the main characters out on the front lines of the battlefield, just to make it extra implausible. Like, a bajillion White Walkers, like, rush over them. Like, they literally do it like a tidal wave of bodies, like, smashes over them. And then they're fighting, and it's all incoherent. And then, like, we get some light, and it's like, oh, good, they all lived. Every other red shirt who was in there, they're all dead. But the main characters who were in the front lines and in no circumstances could survive that, they're all alive. And then it would be like, oh, shit, more bodies, oh, fight. And then they'll cut away and do something else for a while. And you're waiting for, like, when we cut back, someone's going to be dead because that was an impossible circumstance we just left them in. And then we will cut back and, like, Jamie and Brienne and fucking Podrick will all be like, oh, man, that was really hard. Can't believe we beat all those White Walkers, guys, right? Oh, God, there's more. And then, like, a billion will come at them again. And then, like, they have an impossible circumstance again. And then they cut away. And that's the whole episode, is waiting for something to happen. Something never happens. It's just a boring fucking episode because it's poorly shot. It's poorly edited. It's poorly put together. And when they telegraph so clearly early on that they're not actually going to do anything to anyone, that you stop kind of tuning in because there's no stakes to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter what's going to happen. And so, you know, there is a very Deus Ex Machina ending. And here we have to get into the whole thing with Arya, because there has been a very obnoxious debate online, to me at least, where, like, kind of, this is one case where I will use the term both sides, where, like,
okay,
there are obviously, yeah, like, dumb sexist pricks who hate the end of the episode because it's Arya and they don't want the girls to do anything. I don't think that's most people who had a problem with the end of this episode. And I also think there's a group who are just like, I like Arya, Arya's cool, if she did the cool thing, I'm cool with it, I loved the episode. And those are kind of the two weird extremes. And they both kind of annoy me. Because really, like, I don't mind that Arya did it. I think there's, like, there's an issue with, I'll say this, in terms of story structure. Arya has nothing to do with the White Walkers. She had literally never met one before this episode. So, like, there isn't the same kind of buildup. Like, when you get to that scene, why it is surprising Arya jumps out is because you weren't thinking about her because she's never had that relationship with this side of the show. So it's odd on that level. I think you could make it work, and some of this will depend on what they do in future episodes. The bigger problem is that the character of Jon Snow, who I like sometimes, I like less other times, I'm not like a Jon Snow stan. But the show has told us very explicitly that the show thinks he's really important. And so I'm just judging this on the parameters the show has given us. So the show has told us Jon Snow is one of the main characters. He's one of the most important. They keep telling us this. He keeps rising in the ranks. People keep falling in love with him and keep giving him, like, he's the king and all this stuff. Like, he's the new king in the north despite being a bastard, all this stuff. So they are telling us he's important, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you could cut every shot with Jon Snow out of this episode. The episode that resolves his primary plot line from episode 1 to now, you could cut every shot with Kit Harington out of the episode would not change substantively. Because he does nothing. He does fuck all in this episode. And it is the third or fourth battle he's been involved in a row where his presence was either a net zero on the battle, as it is here, or a net negative, as in, like, the Battle of the Bastards or the thing beyond the wall they did last season where he's just an idiot and fucks shit up. And you cannot have a character be told that they are that important and fuck up that badly or be that just fundamentally unimportant to the resolution of their own story and also have another character come in and resolve that at the same time. This is the, like, conflux of events and tie in the whole Deus Ex Machina of Arya is not the Deus Ex Machina. The Deus Ex Machina is that you could stab the guy once and all of the White Walkers die, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's that conflux of things going on where the character who was most attached to this story does nothing in this episode. A character who had never been attached to this story resolves the episode, and the way it's resolved is so easy and requires so little sacrifice on the part of the characters we know that you come out of it just feeling bored and frustrated and feeling like you kind of got duped watching the show, you know?
Yeah, no, like, and that is the sentiment that has been expressed by most people that I know that were disappointed by the episode. Was this just like a, like, whether or not they were able to articulate it, it is the sense of Lady Me from Doctor Who has nothing to do with this. And so even if, like, in the real world, it doesn't matter. Like, it does in real life, it doesn't matter whether or not she would know anything about the, as long as she's there and she's an assassin, she could assassinate it. So it's like, I think I've seen some people kind of defend it on those grounds a little bit. But this is, but Game of Thrones, despite, you know, obviously it's sort of trying to ground itself in some sort of fantasy realism, it's still a story. It's not like a documentary of events that actually occurred. You still have to construct things in such a way that it has impact and import and meaning as a story and a narrative. And you can't do that by having your sort of plot lines intersect in such a way that kind of defeats the purpose of one of your major characters.
Yeah, and because that's the defense people are making is like, no, guys, Arya trained for 3 seasons. And I'm like, exactly. Okay, I'm not arguing. No one's arguing about that. Of course she has the skills to do it. Like, that's not that, and I know some people are arguing about that, and it is a stupid argument. The fact that she would have the ability to do this is not at argument to me. What is at argument is everything I just said, and also something people are ignoring, which is that people have forgot this very conveniently this season. Arya was written like absolute shit for 3 seasons. After seasons 1 through 4, she's like the best character. Seasons 5 and 6... they put her in the worst corner of the story with the worst plot lines, and Maisie Williams half the times looks miserable. Like, you know why she was so excited on Doctor Who, Sean? It's because she had good writing for, like, mm-hmm. the first time in a couple fucking years. And then season 7, like, there's one good scene with her, and then the rest of it is just, they also strand Sansa in it, and it's just the worst god-awful writing. So, like, part of that to me is just also, like, they've tried to rehabilitate Arya this season and make her a real character again. And I just, you can't do that to a character for 3 seasons and then have me buy it. And it's not Maisie Williams' fault, it's not Arya's fault, but it is the way the show went. So, like, all of that annoys me. All the stuff with the dragons in this episode was so utterly fucking baffling. You just have Jon and Daenerys up on their dragons doing fuck all, not helping anyone, just flying around in a fucking storm. It's just, like, it's one of those episodes of television where every creative choice made on a writing side of things was the wrong creative choice, and it is one of the most important episodes they've done, and it really, like, my grand unified theory for why Game of Thrones has kind of gone off the rails in its later seasons is twofold. One, they went off books, and it's very much like an anime situation where the anime surpasses the manga, and the writers do not know how to write this story. That just very clearly happened. But two, I think Game of Thrones got too popular, they got too much money, and Benioff and Weiss decided, and HBO decided, the heart of the show is big, spectacular battle scenes, not good character writing with, like, motivations and logic and themes. And so the battles and the spectacle get prioritized above everything else. And when that happens, you know, and you go into them unmotivated and you don't really care about the logic of them, bad storytelling happens. And I think that's, like, I think if Game of Thrones had a third of the budget it had at this point, it would be a much better show.
Hmm.
So, oh well.
Yeah, no, everything you're saying is stuff I've heard from other people. So it's just like, it's been very interesting to watch this happen with Game of Thrones of like the, for some people, it's just this like, because there's a part of me that feels like no matter what they did, there's no satisfying conclusion to, for some people, for like what had been built up, because eventually, for a lot of people that I know, it has always felt like one of the main things they liked about Game of Thrones was that it surprised them constantly with like the deaths or whatever it is. And then if that is your thing, like eventually the show is always going to disappoint you, because eventually it has to become a story. Like eventually it has to, it's kind of like with Mass Effect 3, you know, one of the reasons why everyone was so disappointed with Mass Effect 3 is that, if, you know, eventually everything can spring out in the middle and you get to be so free and open in the middle of a story, regardless if it's a video game with choices or not, the middle, you get to just be very expansive and episodic. Eventually it all has to come to a single point. And if you're not willing to sort of just go along with whatever it is to that point, you're just going to be very frustrated with it. But it does also sound like on top of that, the writing team maybe just doesn't know how to handle that, even on just the level of let's just make it a conventional story, abandon some of like trying to make it surprising, but let's make the conventional story like at least executed on a like solid level fundamentally. It sounds like they're just not capable of doing that.
Yeah, and you compare it to, I hate to be the guy who's always comparing things to the books, but it is just night and day to me of like, even the books people don't like, books 4 and 5, which I will stand for, I think they're really good. I just think George R. R. Martin is a fundamentally solid storyteller in a way the creative team of the show is not. And I think a lot of people miss this too. They went off books after book 3, they ignored books 4 and 5, so like, they made a conscious choice of like, we really only wanted to adapt the first 3 of Martin's books and then we wanted to do our own thing. And when they go off that path, you have this very clear, like, books 4 and 5 frustrated a lot of people because I don't think they go as deep into the story as people wanted. But that's because Martin is laying groundwork and telling story and letting things go at, I think, an organic pace. And Game of Thrones, the show, decided, no, that's boring. Let's cut some steps here and get to the fun stuff and have big battles. And that's where it kind of falls apart for me. So I'm in this point also where like, I have no fucking idea what the next episode is. And it's not in a way where like, this is exciting. I have no idea where they're going. It's like, I don't fucking like, because like the way they portrayed it, if the armies of the North, if they have enough people left alive to fight Cersei in the South, it's the biggest fucking cop out because we saw them all die. Like everyone who was not a named character died in the last episode. And of course, they're going to have to do that because that's where the story has to go. So it's like they only have cop-outs left. It's very baffling to me. And it was especially funny, this being the weekend of Avengers Endgame also, which I feel like is the polar opposite of that in terms of like earning its story beats. So I don't know. I've ranted probably too long for this, but people actually ask us a lot to talk about Game of Thrones. So there you go. Game of Thrones talk.
Well, and I will say there's something weird about... Because because my narrative for like my personal thing with Game of Thrones as it had been when it started in like 2012, like God, it's been a long time. 11, yeah. So yeah, because I remember it was right around when we started college. So when that started, that was where I had just gone off of this streak of a number of things of like Lost. That was when I started watching Breaking Bad, and there were a couple of other shows I had started watching just before they were getting to their last season. And I made this dumb mistake of like, oh, I'll just watch Breaking Bad up to like through season 4 or whatever it was. And then I'll try to watch the last ones episodically. And that's just not the way I watch television, other than like Doctor Who. And the main reason why I do that with Doctor Who is because we have this podcast. If we did not have the podcast, I'm not sure I would have started watching Doctor Who that way. Because the podcast keeps me on that episodic schedule. But so that meant that I was like, no, I'm not going to start this with fucking Game of Thrones, because even though people say it's really good and it looked really good, I'm going to wait till it's done. Not thinking that it was going to run for 8 seasons, like most things don't do that. And it's probably expecting like, in like 4 years, Game of Thrones will be done and I'll watch fucking Game of Thrones. And so that's where I started. It was just like, I'm just not going to watch it. I'm not going to bother with it. It's fine. I don't watch television that way. I will just wait. And then around the... And then it started getting a little bit hard to resist that. But I was like, no, I'm just going to wait. And then around season 5 or season 6, where some people started to turn a bit more on the show and be like, I feel like that was around the time where there was the controversy around one of the rape scenes in the show and that kind of stuff. And some of like the... I feel like there were people that turned on the politics of Game of Thrones in a way that made me feel like maybe I just don't need to watch Game of Thrones. Like, maybe this will just be fine and I'll just never have to watch it. And that's the mode I've been in until now with Season 8, Episode 3, and so many people being like, this is horseshit. Weirdly, now I'm like, you know what? Game of Thrones is almost over. I might just spend the summer watching Game of Thrones because there's something now about so many people turning on it that has gotten me over the edge to being like, I want to see it be really good at the beginning, and then I want to see it get maybe rough and bad at the end, because that sounds almost more interesting to me than it just being this very, like, pristine show that everyone says is perfect. There's something about it, like, ending in a very sullied place that's like okay, yeah, now I'm going to watch Game of Thrones. So that might be something I do over the summer. I don't know.
I would be super curious, and I'd love to do the episode where we talk about it. You watch that, and I'll watch Mobile Suit Gundam or something. But like,
fuck yeah, if that's the deal I have to make to watch you, I will definitely watch Game of Thrones if that means you will watch fucking Gundam.
I feel like I get the better end of the deal there. But yes, I think, I don't know if you would like it or not. I think the first 4 seasons are great television. I think season 6 is partially great television. 5 is bad. 7 is bad. 8. I don't fucking know anymore. So yeah, it's super curious. I would just be curious if you would be able to spot the point where like, oh, they're really off book now. They're telling a different story now.
Yeah. I suspect I would, because I've watched more than enough anime at this point that has done that. It can be very clear that it's like, there's just a totally different authorial voice. It's like, you know, when you're like watching Naruto, it's like is this a filler episode? Look at my phone. This is a fucking filler episode, even though they're not like, it's not a like, we're on the ghost pirate ship or whatever, but yeah. like they're trying to disguise it. It's like, you can't know. Like, it's so obvious that this is not the same authorial voice, because the authorial voice from the source material is very distinct. So yeah, because that is another thing that just like, that kind of makes me want to watch Game of Thrones, to just see that shift happen.
Yeah.
And then maybe I'll read the books. Who knows? Who knows how that will go?
The books, the thing is with the books, Sean, is definitely wait until those are done, because they might never be done. And I hate that I am in the position where I've read them and there's a good chance there will never be another one. And that is frustrating in a way that it's like having a fucking phantom limb that's just like itching over here and I can never scratch it.
Yeah.
Not to trivialize people with phantom limbs. I'm sorry if I did that. But let's go ahead and move on, Sean. You want to talk about the news?
What's going on in the news, Jonathan?
Well, we have to start with some really sad news. Peter Mayhew, who played Chewbacca in the Star Wars movies, passed away this week at 74. We knew he had had some health problems for a while. This is why he passed the role of Chewbacca on to Junis Suotomo. They both played him in The Force Awakens, and then after that, it's been Junis. But yeah, I mean, Peter Mayhew, man, what can you say other than Chewbacca is one of the best and most iconic characters of like modern day cinema, and Chewbacca is the work of a lot of people. You know, you have whoever designed the awesome costume, you have Ben Burtt doing all the cool Chewbacca sound effects, but the guy who's there on set every day bringing Chewbacca to life, being there physically with the other actors, was Peter Mayhew. And I don't think there's any way to look at him in Star Wars and not say it's a great performance.
Yeah, I think it's easy for some people to sort of underestimate the value that he brought to the character because it's so disguised under all the costume and everything. But Chewbacca's just like an all-time great physical performance of a character. And you know, it's the main thing that imbues Chewbacca with life is that physicality and that physical performance, and that gives him that sense of character. So yeah, like his role in that character is the core and the heart of what Chewbacca is.
And it's just, it's so sad to think about him being gone, because he's passed away and Carrie Fisher has passed away. And that just, you know, that's half of the original Star Wars, like, foursome right there, you know? Mm-hmm. Because it's not just Han, Luke, and Leia. It's Han, Luke, Leia, and Chewie, you motherfuckers. Chewie is an equal participant to me, and I think to a lot of people. And, man, there are not many people who get to say they brought to life a character that iconic and beloved as Chewbacca what a fucking legacy Peter Mayhew leaves behind on that level. I would definitely look up some of the things his successor now, Junis Suotomo, has said about him, because they got to work together very closely as Mayhew passed off the role, and he said some very lovely things, and he's done a great job playing Chewie since. But yeah, I also learned this week, someone was saying this on the Konzenshu forums, the Dragon Ball forums, I did not know this, Peter Mayhew voiced a character in the English dub of Dragon Ball GT, A Hero's Legacy, which is the Dragon Ball GT television special. So he was also a part of the Dragon Ball universe in a very minor way. He voiced a character named Susha. And I just thought that was an interesting credit, because he's mostly known for Chewbacca, and rightfully so. But I thought, you know, we talk about Dragon Ball on here, that's worth including.
There's got to be, like, a fascinating story about how Peter Mayhew ended up playing that character. There's got to be some, like, he had kids or someone that, like, loved Dragon Ball. Like, there's just got to be something interesting on how... Because that's such a specific, strange credit for an actor to have.
He probably, you know what I'll guess? He was probably at some kind of film festival event in Austin, and that's where Funimation is, and probably met Sean Schimmel or Chris Sabat there or something. And they were like, hey, you want to come do a voice in the booth for us? And they're like, okay. That's probably how it happened.
Yeah, because it's just, you don't get actors outside of like the Funimation camp or whatever playing bit roles on Dragon Ball almost ever. Like, it's very rare.
Yeah, but man, rest in peace. I hope you and Chewie get all of the medals up in heaven.
Exactly.
Star Wars Episode 9 better give Chewie a fucking medal. I just got to say right now, JJ, I don't care how convoluted it is. You're going to have to go into that movie with a dedication to Peter Mayhew at the end. Chewie better have a medal around his neck by the end of that fucking movie. Make up for that mistake 40 years ago now. That's all I
got to
say about that. Yeah,
with all the bullshit fan pandering that has been in the sequel trilogy, you can do some like meaningful fan pandering for once.
Yes. Chewie deserves medals with interest.
Yes.
All right, Sean. You want to move on to the real news of the week?
Do I, Jonathan? Do it? Does any of us?
Sonic the Hedgehog is a movie. It exists. And there's a trailer. It's 2.5 minutes long. I wrote on the outline, Sonic the Hedgehog trailer shocks and horrifies humanity. And that, if anything, might be downplaying it, Sean. Is this the worst movie trailer you've ever seen?
It's bad. Like, it's really bad. Like, even if you just take the I like Sonic the Hedgehog part out of it, just the... There's that, like, 30-second extended... quote-unquote comedy scene with Jim Carrey in the middle of the trailer where he like meets up with all the military people that is just one of the most excruciatingly unfunny things I've ever fucking seen in a movie trailer.
You know what it made me think of was him in Series of Unfortunate Events back in like 03, yeah. Where it was, and it's like, what year are we in? Because this does not feel like the trailer for a movie from 2019. It feels like one of those flop sweaty family comedies from 2003 or 4.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, there's something very surreal about, it's just Jim Carrey just hasn't been in anything for so long that just having him pop up like out of a fucking time warp, because this is the character he would have played if they made a Sonic the Hedgehog movie in the early 2000s, like fresh off of The Grinch, he's Dr. Robotnik in Sonic the Hedgehog. It's just so peculiar. But it is just like the jokes and the timing and the pacing, especially because they don't even edit that scene very much for like the trailer. It just feels like this is just the way this scene is edited in the movie kind of thing, in a way that they're like, we're very confident in this joke, because normally you only put the jokes in the trailers that you're very confident in. And if that's one of the jokes, if they're very confident in that joke and they're very confident in the joke that Sonic the Hedgehog is in the bag outside the elevator, he's like, oh, it's a child, but it's not my child. If that's the humor that they're like, these are some of our best jokes, let's put in the trailer, that's a dark fucking sign for the other jokes in this movie.
The thing that... We'll get to Sonic's design in a bit. That's a whole other discussion.
Yeah, apparently they will too.
Yeah. Apart from that, though, the thing that makes this trailer... go all the way through, like, the chasms of hell, looping through the worst possible, and then coming back around to being almost so bad it's awesome, is Gangsta Paradise. I mean, what fucking year is it that you are using Gangster's Paradise in your Sonic the Hedgehog movie trailer? Like, that is a song that has... One, that song is from 1995. It's from the year my brother was born. And it's like, and that song has gone through so many cultural cycles of like relevancy and then being a joke with Weird Al doing Amish Paradise and then back around to being kind of cool. And then all the way back here where it's just like Hollywood gentrification, where you put it in your fucking Sonic trailer and have Sonic do an action. He's like drumming along with Gangster's Paradise. Who thought that was the cool thing? Like what person, what caveman executive frozen in the year 1997 was unfrozen to make this movie? Because that's what it feels like.
It's so peculiar. It's so utterly fucking inexplicable to me that that is the song. It never, like, if we spent hours on the podcast just listing songs that could potentially be the pop song in the Sonic the Hedgehog trailer, Gangsta's Paradise literally never would have come up because there's no reason to. It has no connection to Sonic other than it being from the period when his original Genesis game's coming out. And
I don't think Sonic, that was the connection.
Like, the song is cool and Sonic's supposed to project coolness, but I don't feel like he's supposed to project gangsta coolness. Like, that's not Sonic's character.
I also got to let me say my piece here on something. This might be controversial. When I was a kid, Sonic was black, all right? Because okay, Jaleel yeah. White voiced Sonic on TV. I know in the games later they've always had white guys do him, but in my head, Sonic is black because Jaleel White was Sonic. And I think there's just something about that and the connection with, like, Michael Jackson doing the music for Sonic 3 and some of that where, like, and some of the, like, kind of hip-hop atmosphere around Sonic where it's, like, there's a certain ballsiness but in the wrong way to do a new Sonic movie, not have Sonic be black anymore, it's Ben Schwartz, but then put Gangster's Paradise in there. It's like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, if you were gonna do, like, the big cool rap song, why couldn't they just let Sonic be black? I don't get it.
Yeah. No, I'm with you.
It's like the least of the movie's problems, but still, like, there's an insensitivity to that that kind of shocks me.
There's another thing I'm disappointed at, which is that we did get Gangsta's Paradise, but we didn't get, like, a weird somber cover of Gangsta's Paradise, which is, like, if you're going to do this, at least have it be a bad somber cover. Like, at least, like, let's go full, like, trailer trope with it and, yes. and go down that strange street we've always been on for the past, like, 5 years.
All right, but Sean, Sonic's design. We thought it was bad from the posters. We thought it was bad from the leaked marketing materials. We had no fucking idea. He is both too small and too tall. He is incomprehensibly slim in a way that is just terrifying to look at. There's like fur, but it's really not photorealistic. Like, it looks like a very poorly made pair of pajamas, like made in a fucking like factory in Bangladesh. And it's just, it's, and like, and put on some poor kid, and then he's got real human teeth, and those eyes are fucked up, and it looks like they're kind of like half mocapping his face, but they didn't finish the mocap, and it looks bad, and he produces electricity now. I don't know where that's from, but whatever. Every possible design decision they could have made about Sonic, they made the wrong one. It's amazing. It's breathtaking.
It's like the brief sequence in the trailer where he's sitting in the passenger seat next to Cyclops from the old X-Men movies, James Marsden, who's the human cop man in this movie. Because that's also one of the things is that apparently that this movie is set in, like, which I feel like we knew this, but it's set in modern day Earth and it's Sonic, CG Sonic with like live action humans and everything. So, you know, it's just doing that. It's, again, to make it feel like it's very outdated, they're doing, like, the Smurfs movie treatment of Sonic or whatever, where he's teleported through a dimensional... I don't know how he got here. I don't know how Sonic got here.
They're literally doing that because the Smurfs people made the movie Hop, which is about the Easter Bunny who lives with James Marsden, and now James Marsden is in the Sonic movie. So, like, it's just, you can take the line from Smurfs to this really easily.
Poor James Marsden. What did he do to deserve this?
James Marsden is an awesome dude. He's very funny. I feel very bad that his career is in this place because I like James Marsden when I see him in things. But, oh God, I don't know. Does he have alimony? What's going on, James Marsden?
Yeah, because, I mean, he just finds himself as an actor sitting in the driver's seat next to what I imagine is some weird, like, green screen dummy or whatever that's the size of a small child. That's because Sonic has his fucking seatbelt on. And it's just like, like you said, he's very small, which is like and he's probably about the right size for Sonic the Hedgehog. The problem is that usually, with some small exceptions, Sonic is not in a world with, like, adult humans. That's really only, like, some of the Sonic Adventure stuff, but, like, there it's very stylized, and it's mostly Sonic 2006, where he makes out with Princess Elise, that you have, like, the Sonic-human interaction. But at least, Elise seems like a slightly shorter young woman, not like I'm, like, a movie actor, normal-sized human being. And so it is, Sonic goes up to, like, his thigh, basically, and it's very weird at seeing him. It looks like he should be sitting on a booster seat, or like he shouldn't be allowed to sit in the passenger seat of the car. It's too dangerous because yes. If the airbag goes off, it's going to break his fucking neck, man. Put him in the back seat. But or why is he even in the car? He's Sonic the Hedgehog. He can run faster than the fucking car. Just have him run there.
Yeah, that's weird. And it is. It's not the size so much as the proportions within that size are so freakish and wrong, and like, I don't care if you've never seen a picture of Sonic the Hedgehog before, when you see Sonic standing in this thing, it looks wrong. No creature could possibly have those proportions. It's just like, it looks like it should be in a fucking Cronenberg movie. Like, this is what Jeff Goldblum crawls into. He gets a hedgehog and Jeff Goldblum and a can of blue paint go in the fucking machine, and this comes out.
Yes, it's just the Brundle hog, and then it's yeah, it's just deformed and melted.
Kill me!
Yeah, it's fucking rough. Oh my god.
It's rough. And you know what? They got the message, because on Thursday, director Jeff Fowler wrote on Twitter that they will be updating the design in the finished film in response to the reactions. Which, I mean, I have so many questions about this, because the movie's coming out in November. There's not enough time to fix this. I don't think you even really can fix this. Like, because they can't change eyeline matches between James Marsden and Sonic. Like, they might be able to do some stuff with the face. But no matter what they do, as people have pointed out, this is going to entail a lot of CGI artists having to do a lot of hard work, probably under horrible crunch conditions, to get this done by November. And I'm betting every one of those artists working in the trenches told Jeff Fowler and the executives over and over again, this looks wrong. I don't like animating this. Please don't make me do this. They're going to hate it. And they're all like, no, this, what's his name? Sonic? Okay, yeah, that's Sonic. Yeah, he's a, what is he, a hedgehog? Okay, yeah. No, they're gonna love it. The kids are gonna love it. Don't worry about it. Because nobody working on this movie knew what the fuck Sonic the Hedgehog was. That's just a guarantee from this trailer.
I mean, can you imagine the depth of the nightmares you would have if your job is to spend hours at a computer screen animating this fucking monstrous, horrific, grotesque creature?
We need... Okay, all the people who are doing all the investigative journalism about, like, Trump and the White House, nothing's going to come of that because there are no consequences for bad behavior anymore. Get off of that, and I want you to do an interview with the guy who did the teeth, because I want to know what that guy's living nightmare is every day, and I think we need our best journalists on it to find out who in the world had to do the teeth on Sonic the Hedgehog, because that guy probably has horrible post-traumatic stress disorder every night.
Yeah, I don't want to think about it too much. I will say one positive thing about the trailer. I do kind of like the bit at the very, very, very end where Jim Carrey looks like Dr. Robotnik, and he's bald, and he's got the big fuck-off mustache, and he looks like he's in Mushroom Hill Zone from Sonic and Knuckles,
yes,
because there are giant mushrooms in the background. And that was like a vision of a, you know what? If that's what this movie was, that would, like, it probably still wouldn't be good, but it would be a more acceptable level of, like, disposable kids movie, as opposed to the, like, atrociously awful kids movie that it looks like it's going to be. But the thing that I'm, like, 95% certain of is that little tiny scene at the very end of the trailer is a little tiny scene at the end of the movie. Because he's going to spend the whole movie just looking like Jim Carrey, and they're going to be on Earth. And then he's going to, like, fall through some sort of portal, and that's how Sonic will beat him. And then you'll get, like, the stinger for the sequel, which is going to be him in Sonic's world. And he's like, hey, Sonic, aha! And he's got the weird mustache, and that's going to be the end of the movie. I'm 95 fucking percent certain that is exactly how this movie ends.
I am with you 100% on that. Yeah, like, that's, if you just gave me that still, if that was the first thing we saw out of this movie, I'd be kind of psyched. I'd be like, that actually looks really cool. But it is one shot, it's not going to be in the movie much, and it's still Jim Carrey under there. I gotta give our listeners some tough love here, Sean, on Jim Carrey. All right?
Yeah.
Everyone loves Jim Carrey now. And I'm not entirely sure why. I know he was in a lot of movies that were mostly bad when we were kids. And we liked those because we were kids and anything entertained us. But I knew by like 2004 that this guy was fucking obnoxious. Like, he's in some good movies. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Truman Show. Very good dramatic actor when you ask him to be. He's also in fucking Ace Ventura and The Grinch and Dumb and Dumber and all this stuff, where some of these movies are better than others. And I agree, he can be funny at times. But the calibration between funny Jim Carrey and ungodly obnoxious Jim Carrey is a really fine calibration. And he fell on the wrong side of that line a lot in his heyday. More than I think we like to remember. And then he disappeared for a number of years. And that made us all kind of sad because we worried about him. What a lot of people don't know or don't like, I think they know this, but they don't like to talk about it, is that during those years he became a prominent anti-vaxxer and is at least partially to blame for, like, I think the culture we have now, because he was, like, in a relationship with Jenny McCarthy, who was one of the celebrities who promulgated all of this, and he promulgated a lot of it, and he doesn't do it much anymore. But, like, I feel like we should talk about that more because, you know, it's a really bad thing to have done. And then now, he's making a comeback, and he did that show on Showtime that it was apparently pretty good, and I'm sure he was fine in that. He's fucking annoying in this trailer. He's, like, that is clearly miscalibrated, obnoxious Jim Carrey, and my nostalgia for Liar Liar does not overwhelm my critical senses in the year 2019. It's annoying. I don't care how much you liked him as a kid. It's fucking annoying. And also, I can't stress this enough, measles is back! And Jim Carrey was one of the people who got us here.
Yep.
So, yeah. Sean, the world is
so weird. I'm not going to see that movie.
No. Sean, when this trailer broke, how much champagne do you think was unleashed at the Detective Pikachu offices? Because this is the best marketing Detective Pikachu could ever have, right?
Oh, God, yeah. It's just that, like, see what, like, you know, even if Detective Pikachu is not the most amazing movie in the world, it's at least going to be respectful of the source material. That is very clear.
Yeah.
And, like, that should be just a bare minimum for these kinds of movies. Apparently, it's basically where we start capping out for movies based on video game properties. It's like, did a majority, or at least a significant number of the people involved in this production, give a shit about the source material that this movie is based on? Yes? Well, good. You're in, like, the top 5 percentile or whatever of video game movies made globally, and all the other ones are just the Persona 3 movies.
Yes, or other random anime productions.
Yes.
All right. Okay, I'm going to skip this next news item because it's not that important. It was just the Avengers Endgame box office numbers are insane and make my eyes boggle. But anyway, I want to go to
We'll probably readdress that once it's overtaken Avatar in like 2 weeks or whatever, or however long it's going to be.
Yeah, I'm very curious about that. But Sean, if you would click the link below that with me.
Yep, no, I'm already there.
Okay, so Microsoft this week released, they updated their community standards for Xbox. This is just, you know, this happens from time to time with anyone with a, you know, terms of use agreement sort of thing, right? And my page is emphatically not loading. Okay, there it goes. All right. But they also, they went beyond just, you know, giving you the basic rules, in that they also provided a lot of examples of trash talk on Xbox Live and what is and is not acceptable. All right? So, Sean, if we go back down to the part where it says, here's some stuff Microsoft recommends you shouldn't be saying online, and then it says, here's acceptable, I'm going to do the unacceptable trash talk, and then, Sean, I want you, in your best, you know, 11-year-old, to do the acceptable trash talk for us, okay?
All right, I can do this.
Okay, so this is in Microsoft's official, like, terms of service now. So here's what you shouldn't be saying. Get sexual threat. Can't believe you thought you were on my level. Hey, profanity. That was some serious potato aim. Get wrecked, trash. Only reason you went positive was you spent all day camping. Kiss, kid. Cheap win. Totally expected from a racial slur. Jeez, that got real really fast. You suck. Get out of my country. Maybe they'll let you back in when your KD's over 1. Wow, that got very weirdly specific at the end, Sean.
Yeah, I wonder if there's maybe like a political moment happening in America that makes it necessary to include the "get out of my country" as a phrase that's not acceptable in trash talk.
Yes. But then, Sean, very helpfully from Microsoft, they gave us a bunch of trash talk that is acceptable. This is, you can go on Xbox Live right now and repeat these words and you're fine.
Yeah, you know how, like, back in the day, Nintendo games got, like, the Nintendo quality seal of approval? Well, these lines, these hot zingers from Microsoft, this gets their seal of approval for trash-talking on Xbox Live. Get destroyed! Can't believe you thought you were on my level! That was some serious potato aim! Get wrecked! Only reason you went positive was you spent all game camping! Try again, kid. Cheap win. Come at me when you can actually drive without running cars off the road. That sucked. Get good, and then come back when your KD's over one.
I have so many questions, Sean. What is potato aim?
I don't know. I really don't know. Because, yeah, that's both... So eagle, you know, eared listeners probably have noticed that these lines are paired. So the unacceptable version was, hey, profanity, that was some serious potato aim, get wrecked, trash. And they edited that down to, that was some serious potato aim, get wrecked. So profanity and trash are not okay, but telling someone that they have, quote, potato aim and telling them to get wrecked is totally kosher?
I gotta say, if I were online and someone told me I had potato aim, I wouldn't be insulted, I would just be confused.
I mean, maybe they would have seen in your case that, like, you know, you're playing from Iowa, so that's where they go for, like, the potato jokes. I don't know.
I mean, they'd be a little off. That's more like Ohio, but sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre to me because there's two parts to this. One part is cool, like, good. You're trying to maybe crack down on trash talking and saying, like, hey, these kinds of things, sexual threats, yelling profanity at people, you know, anything involving a racial slur or references to people getting out of the country, all of those things are not allowed and not acceptable as trash talk. Like, that's good, cool. Thank you for getting that message out there, Microsoft. The part that feels a little bit miscalculated is this idea that then meant the onus was on them to provide acceptable examples of trash talk, which is like, no. You don't, nobody's asking for that from you, Microsoft. And it's like, you shouldn't, like saying that these are examples of trash talk that is acceptable is basically you tacitly admitting, like it's a good thing. Like, we want people to trash talk this way. It's just like a no. Like, anybody who says, that sucked, get good, and then come back when your KD's over one, that person's a fucking asshole. Yo, and you don't want to be playing online with them.
Why doesn't
and
it's it not just say, don't trash talk, it's mean? Like, that's... Nobody likes this. What the hell is going on? It's so bizarre.
Yeah, and it's something where, like, I don't think that somebody saying, cheap win, come at me when you can actually drive without running cars off the road. Okay, that was a bad example because that one I don't understand... That come at me when you can actually drive without running cars off the road is such a bizarrely specific example. Let's go to that was serious, some serious potato aim, get wrecked. Like, telling someone to get wrecked online is lame and you shouldn't do it and you're probably a dick if you do it all the time. But I don't think that someone should be banned from
no.
Xbox Live for saying that the way they I think they should if they're like shouting racial slurs. That being said, you shouldn't then put out a message that's like, well, it is totally okay for you to say get wrecked just because you shouldn't ban people for it. You should just, like, quietly accept that people are going to trash talk online but not bring attention to the acceptable examples, only bring attention to the unacceptable examples. It's such a bizarre move that Microsoft made in
it's
doing
like,
this, but I kind of am astounded by it.
Let me give you an example, Sean. Most syllabuses for college classes have some do's and don'ts, right?
Yes.
And one of the don'ts usually is like, don't be on your phone during class, right? Don't do that.
Uh-huh.
Most college syllabuses don't list out like, though, that like if you fall asleep in class, they don't do that, right? Like, it's generally understood societally, like if you're going to go to a class, you shouldn't fall asleep, right?
Uh-huh.
But it's not in the rules. Like, it's not in like the college bylines that you will get expelled for that, you know? The flip side of that would be like if in the syllabus they said, okay, don't use your phone in class, but if you want to sit in the front row and take a nap, do it. You're not going to get kicked out or get an F, so therefore, sleep away. Classrooms are for nap time. Like, it's such a weird usage of like the do's and don'ts structure of like, obviously there's always going to be bad behavior that is not penalized. That doesn't mean it should be accepted.
Yeah, it is
or
like,
encouraged in this case.
Like, you just don't have the onus to provide examples of what you can do up to the level of it being unacceptable. Like, you don't have to give people examples of like a, you know, oh, you did, you know, you can't have your cell phone out and like openly texting in the middle of class, but it would be totally acceptable if you had it sort of like in your pocket and you were doing it subtly so that nobody could see you. Like, putting that in the syllabus is like, well, yeah, if nobody's noticing it, you can't catch it. Of course, it's technically acceptable in some weird way that we're not going to penalize you for it, but you shouldn't indicate to people that that's something that you could do. Like, you just say, don't fucking use your cell phone in class, and that's all you have to say about it, and then you deal with everything else.
Yeah. It's bizarre, but also, I love that Microsoft wrote this out, because now we all have the term potato aim in our vernacular, and that's, I can't wait, Sean, after this podcast, I'm going to go boot up Fortnite and yell at some 12-year-olds for their potato aim.
Yep, tell them that the only reason they went positive was they spent all game camping. Try again, kid.
All right, you want to move on?
Yeah, let's move on.
We're all living in a Pokemon world today, because we are talking about Pokemon, the first movie. Really, I think one of the most conveniently titled films of all time, because it really tells you, like, this is the first one. It's very easy to find. No one's confused on which is the first Pokemon movie.
Yeah, it's not like the Indiana Jones movies, where it's like they all have different subtitles and there's no numbers. It's like you're looking at the list of Pokemon movies, you're like, oh, here's Pokemon the movie 2000. Was that the first one? Here's Pokemon Forever. Is that the fourth Pokemon movie, or is it they're just using the word Forever as a subtitle? And then you say, Pokemon the first movie, gotcha. That's the first fucking movie.
All right. So why are we talking about this movie today? It's because there's a number of reasons, as we said. 2019 is the 20th anniversary of Pokemon the first movie. This came out in the year 1999 in the United States. And we are going to be talking about the American release of this, obviously, today. We'll get into that more later. So this is the 20th anniversary of it. The Pokemon movie this year in Japan is going to be a movie called Mewtwo Strikes Back Evolution, which is a CGI remake of this film, which we've talked about some of the screenshots we saw before. That will be the 22nd Pokemon movie, by the way, Sean. And I really hope when it comes out here, it says Pokemon the 22nd movie, because that would be great.
Oh my God, that's a lot of movies.
It's a lot of movies. So that's happening this year. But of course, the big reason why we're doing it this week is next week is Detective Pikachu. And Detective Pikachu looks like it's set to, I think, change a lot of paradigms in that it seems like it's a video game movie made by people who like the video games, which is, again, shouldn't be a high bar to clear, but it's been a very high bar to clear. It's getting good reviews. It looks like it's going to be good. It's almost certainly going to be the highest grossing video game movie of all time. I don't think there's any doubt about that. You know, before this, 20 years ago, the last Pokemon, the first Pokemon movie was a similar sea change moment in that no anime really before or since has had the kind of wide release that Pokemon the first movie had. This Pokemon movie was just, it was a big release in theaters. It was like Star Wars or Jaws or, you know, whatever you're going to go see in a movie theater, right? It was just there. You went to see it. There was no special screenings. It was just a normal major movie. It made a ton of money. The first one made $100 million in the U.S. And it was just a big release. It was by Warner Brothers. And that really has not happened before or since. Pokemon 2003 also had major theatrical runs, but they didn't do as well. And then after that, they petered off. 4 and 5 were in theaters, but only in very limited engagements. And then the last two movies, movie 20 and 21... did get, like, Fathom Events screenings. You know, Dragon Ball Super Broly earlier this year is probably the biggest an anime has done in the U.S. since Pokemon the first movie, but even then, it was a fairly limited engagement in that it was only a week or two. Again, Pokemon was a just big in theaters everywhere. Of course, 1999 was the year that Pokemon was taking over the world. I think it's very surreal to be sitting here and talking about it in a way where Pokemon is unlike most other media franchises, where what we're talking about right now, Sean, it's nostalgic to us. It's our childhood. It's a long time ago. And yet Pokemon has not waned in popularity. Mm-hmm. It is as big as it ever was. In some ways, it is bigger. But it was a big deal back then. And Pokemon, the first movie, was kind of the apotheosis of that first wave of the Pokemon hype worldwide. And I think for that reason alone, it's really interesting to go back and talk about. So we'll talk about the movie, obviously, but also there's all of this, the meta story around the movie that we're talking about, right? And yes, I'm curious about that, too. So, Sean, I'll just throw it to you. In 1999, when this movie came out, you know, like, where were you? What are your memories of it? What kind of Pokemon fan were you?
So, God, so I was 7 years old, and Red and Blue was out, but Gold and Silver was yet to come out, correct? Because Gold and Silver is 2000?
In the U.S., yes.
Yes. So, because that's part of the thing about this movie also, is that it gave you a sneak peek at a handful of characters like Meryl, Snubbull. There was another one that were Pokemon that were new Pokemon that you had never seen before, that were going to be Pokemon in the next phase for Gen 2. And that was one of the things that was very strange. I remember about seeing the movie was like there are going to be new Pokemon. Like, what the Togepi and all this shit. Like, what the fuck is all this shit? And
yeah, that's exactly what you were saying as a 7 year old in the theater. You see Meryl. What the fuck is all this shit?
What the fuck is, what's a Meryl? And why did like every 2 minutes in this weird 20-minute short in front of the movie is there just a psychedelic dance sequence by a bunch of Mankeys or whatever.
We'll get there.
Yeah, but yeah, so I was in love with Pokemon when I was seven. You know, I've talked about before that Pokemon Red was like, when we got that game, that is one of the ways I learned how to read was playing that game. And my parents got it for a Game Boy Color in Red for me, a Game Boy Color in Blue for my brother, because we're going on a road trip that summer, so we got them on Easter, which is like the only time we've ever gotten an Easter present that was like not just here's a candy bar, which made every subsequent Easter since I was 6 years old has been incredibly disappointing to me, because there's just, it's like a here's a candy bar and we're having like a nicely cooked ham for dinner. It's like, great, thanks. Where's my fucking Game Boy? Give me a fucking Pokemon game, Mom. What's going on here? But yeah, so I played Pokemon all the time. I watched the show constantly. You know, and I collected Pokemon trading cards. Like, I didn't know how to play the game. I still don't really know how to play the Pokemon trading card game. But I would collect the cards. I would even collect, I don't know if you ever did this, Jonathan, or knew about them, but when you had Lunchables, they had little cardboard circles
on
the back of Lunchables. Yeah, that were different Pokemon, pictures of Pokemon that you could collect. So I collected those. Like, basically everything that was Pokemon related at the time, I consumed voraciously, including going and seeing Pokemon the first movie and getting the Mew trading card and getting all that stuff. Jonathan's showing me his. He found his. I know where mine is. I didn't bother to get it out.
Yeah.
Because it's like in the storage room in a binder behind a bunch of shit. And I don't want to get that right now. Just for something that, for a podcast that I can show you and the listeners would not see. If you can just Google cool Mew trading card Pokemon movie and you can probably see it online. It was very cool. It's got like Egyptian looking hieroglyphic thingies on it. It was very dope. And there was also stuff of like, I think it was at Burger King, they had like weird like toys that had like, it was like a gold card,
gold plated. So I had one of these. I had this, I think this was for Pokemon 2000, but it was, they had a gold plated, the one I got was a Jigglypuff, and it was in a Pokeball, and you opened it and it was a gold plated Jigglypuff card. I wonder where that is, because it was kind of cool to have. But yeah, you got that at Burger King.
I want to say that mine was a Poliwhirl, or one of the related evolutions. And my memory of this is like very mixed with, for me, the distinction between Pokemon the first movie and Pokemon the movie 2000 is very thin. Like, I know the movies distinctly very well, but the everything swirling around it, like that was for me, like that was Pokemon. And then after, like, Gold and Silver came out and I played some Gold and Silver, and I never finished those games, and then after that, I stopped watching the Pokemon cartoon, and kind of just left Pokemon for most of the rest of my life. Like, I would dip in for Emerald and stuff like that. But I, like, even though I do there's a part of me that still considers myself to be a Pokemon fan in a weird way. When I actually look back on the history of my life, I'm 100% just a fair-weather Pokemon fan that liked Pokemon when it was super popular and I was a little kid, and all the Pokemon were good Pokemon, except for Jinx, was the one bad Pokemon that they had. Everyone else was good. And then after that, it was like, then they introduced a bunch of Pokemon, some of them cool, but some of them not cool. And once you get like fucking Zigzagoon or whatever in there, I ain't fucking in for that shit. You get rid of it. I don't need that stuff. And so then I moved on with my life.
Confession time.
Yes. I feel like we talked about this before, but it bears repeating your relationship with all the Pokemon movies and all that stuff.
You know this better than our listeners do, because you and I have had this conversation. I think we've mentioned this on the podcast, but I don't talk about this a lot. Pokemon was my thing as a kid. Like it was my number one fandom. I was into Pokemon more than anything else. The year I would have gotten into Pokemon was 1999, because I know it was the year of the first movie. The games came out here in 98. I would have started playing 99, because that's also when I got my Game Boy Color, and I would have had Red. No, I started with Yellow, actually, is I think the first one I got, because I remember renting it from a Blockbuster, because that's how it worked back then.
Man, yeah, renting Game Boy games always felt like devious because they're so small that it's, and you're taking it with you. This like, am I supposed to be able to do this? This feels wrong.
Yep.
I rented Super Mario Land and it was like, I feel bad playing this game. Like, I shouldn't be doing this.
It's very bizarre. My local library now checks out Nintendo Switch games, and I feel like it would be the same thing for me on that. Like, if I borrowed a Switch game, it would be like, I could just take this. No one would fucking know. But yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yes, I know that was the year I got into it, and I stayed into Pokemon for so long that I don't even really know when I fell off. I know I have seen every episode of the Pokemon anime through all of the Kanto stuff, so Indigo League, all of the Orange Islands, all of Johto, and I think I saw almost all of the Advanced Generation animes, which was all the Ruby and Sapphire stuff. I know I didn't make it to the very end of that because I've never seen any of the Diamond and Pearl anime. And I know that Diamond and Pearl was the first Pokemon game that I did not finish and was disappointed with. I have played every Pokemon game since then. I've played every mainline Pokemon game. Some I've finished, some I haven't, but I've been into it throughout. I saw all of that anime. Like I remember the Pokemon anime was on Kids WB at 4 o'clock Mountain Time. And I got off of school at 3, and I would get home, and I would sit at the counter, and I would have a snack, and I would watch Pokemon, and I loved it. It was that was my jam. I saw all the movies in theaters, because you had Pokemon 1, 2, 3 were all major theatrical releases. I saw all of those. Pokemon Forever was the first one that they did as a limited release. This is also when Miramax started distributing them. So yes, Pokemon was briefly distributed by Disney. Whatever.
And it will be again one day.
I think Sun and Moon is on Disney XD is where it airs. So,
oh, shit.
Like, Disney doesn't own it, but yeah, I think that's because there's no Kids WB anymore. But yeah, so I would have seen all of those in theaters. Then Pokemon Forever comes out. It's a limited run movie. And we had to go to the AMC Westminster Promenade for that one, I remember. And that's like 40 minutes from where we lived. So I had to go see that. Pokemon Heroes, the fifth one, was playing at Denver West, right near our house. So we got to stay home for that one. And I saw Pokemon Heroes that way. And then after that, they stopped putting Pokemon movies in theaters because I was the only kid in the theater at that point. And I was probably too old for it. But I bought Pokemon Jirachi Wishmaker on VHS when it came out because that's how they put it out. And that movie sucks. But anyway, and then I did see the one after that, Destiny Deoxys, because they aired it on Cartoon Network. I have not seen the Pokemon movies since movie 7, but I've seen the first 7 Pokemon movies. I have seen hundreds of episodes of the anime. I was into this. Sean, I even have, because I found it when we were moving, my fucking Pokemon trading card book, which I have so many of these fucking trading cards. I didn't even have any idea I had this many of these fucking things, but there's way too many in here. There's a lot, and I have my weird illustrations. Where?
Pikachu.
I'm a bad artist. Here's all of the starters.
Oh, no.
Do I need to post these for our audience?
Please, please take some pictures of that and put it on the website.
Okay.
Please.
It's embarrassing. I was a little kid. But anyway, Pokemon was my jam. I've still got those original 6 movies on VHS at home. I have no way to play them, and I had to rebuy some of the movies on DVD for today because I had to be able to see them somehow. But yeah, like Pokemon was just, it was what I played all the time. Ruby and Sapphire on the GBA, I distinctly remember that was when I was starting to play games a lot. And I've beaten Ruby and Sapphire probably like 10 times as a kid. Like, I just played that game over and fucking over again, because also my dad was a cheapskate and we very rarely got new games. So anyway, yeah. I probably did too much Pokemon stuff. And definitely I was still into it at a point where it was not socially acceptable with my peers. So
yeah, I mean, Pokemon Diamond came out when we started high school.
Yeah.
That was the first one on the DS.
Yep.
So that's like a timeline for people for our relative ages. Yeah, and so for me, I don't think I made it explicit, but I only saw the first two Pokemon movies, Pokemon the first movie. I honestly cannot tell you if I saw Pokemon the movie 2000 in the theaters or if I just watched it on Cartoon Network, because Cartoon Network would just show these movies constantly. Like, I've seen Pokemon the first movie a bunch of times. Like, and probably I saw that movie more on Cartoon Network than I watched it on the fucking VHS we own, because I actually do know exactly where VHS is. But yeah, so like, and then for the Pokemon anime, for me, I was never, like, it was never my favorite thing, and I'd never watched it sort of in a dedicated fashion of like the way I would watch Dragon Ball, where it's like, I've like every time Dragon Ball was on, I would have to watch Dragon Ball, and if I had like fucking basketball practice or something, or a basketball like scrimmage that was on when Dragon Ball was supposed to be on, I'd be upset that I would have to miss. And I always missed the fucking episode where Gohan and Krillin fought Guldo. I missed that episode so many fucking times, it pissed me off. I've seen it now, and I've seen it like 5 times now, so I'm good now. But when I was a kid, it upset me. So Pokemon was never one of those for me. But I did watch it on and off up to like some of the Orange Island stuff when the dude from Pokemon Snap was there, and that was the point where I was like, because again, it was for a lot of me like the switching from the first generation into the second generation. It was exciting and cool at first, and then I just realized I just don't know if I have it in me to try to build up an emotional attachment to Cyndaquil or whoever, because Charmander's my boy and I will never leave him behind. And I've just never been able to move on from that point. And I just don't have enough love in my heart for 1,000 Pokemon. I've only got enough love in my heart for 150 Pokemon, which is all of them except for Jinx, but including Mew and Mewtwo.
Nice.
So that's it for as far as the anime goes. Because when I was a kid, I was like the dickhead kid that was like, but Digimon is way better. Because it is. Like, the Digimon show was so much fucking better than the Pokemon show. It's not even a competition.
And see, I have gone back and watched some of the Pokemon anime, like, from my youth. And, you know, I was watching this movie again last night and everything. I still have positive feelings towards it. I like the original Pokemon show. I think, like, the basic structure where Ash is the main character, but it's more of kind of an anthology show of, like, it's about going to new places and meeting new people, and Ash, who's kind of just a fucking putz, you know, like, the best stories are not really about him. Like, the reason the first movie is kind of cool is because Mewtwo is the main character, and, like, you know, I think there's something fun about this constant sense of Pokemon is always moving forward, they're always finding new things, they're meeting new people, they tend to hit upon some pretty cool stories along the way. It's very formulaic and procedural, but I think they were able to do a lot of cool things within that formulaic procedure. And, you know, I think there's also something about, like, Pokemon has only ever come out over here dubbed. There's never been an official release of any Japanese version of Pokemon. They're very, like, they keep a fucking iron curtain between that. But Pokemon has also always generally been pretty well dubbed for what it is. Like, I think it was the one show 4Kids did that they were well equipped to do, you know, because 4Kids shat all over everything else they did, like Yu-Gi-Oh and One Piece. But I think they got Pokemon pretty much right. Like, I have a lot of affection for a lot of those voices, and I even think there's some performances that are really, really good, like Maddie Blaustein, who does Meowth. Meowth just has one of the coolest voices in animation, and I love that. So there's, and you know, this is so inexorably like tied to nostalgia for me that you can't separate them, but those are kind of my general feelings.
And so now feels like the appropriate time for me to confess something to you, Jonathan.
Okay.
Which is, when I started watching Pokemon the first movie this morning, I started watching, so you very kindly ripped the DVD that you have and shared it with me so that I could watch it. Because it's actually weirdly kind of hard to get a decent copy of it.
We'll talk about that in a second, yeah.
Yeah, so I started watching it, and I got like 5 to 10 minutes in, and I realized I had vastly overestimated the amount of nostalgia I had for Pokemon the first movie, and realized I couldn't, even though the movie's only like 70 minutes long, I couldn't quite watch it that way. So instead, I just torrented the Japanese version online and watched that one,
Okay.
And that's a much better movie. And I did, like, piece my way through Pokemon the first movie, the English version, to remind myself of some of the pivotal scenes and compare them. But yeah, I actually don't entirely agree with your assessment that 4Kids did not shit on it, because they're basically different movies at some point.
Okay, this is it. I'm excited to talk about this because I'm sure you're right. I have not seen a lot of Pokemon in Japanese. I would love to at least go through maybe some of the movies and watch them in Japanese, because I know this one, they changed a lot. And yeah, so maybe it is just a haze of nostalgia for me. But let's talk about what we watched, because, yes, if you try to watch a modern DVD, Blu-ray, digital stream, or whatever of Pokemon the first movie, what they're selling is just the movie portion, and they don't have the short Pikachu's Vacation, which aired in the way this always worked was when you went to the theaters, there was a Pikachu short and then the movie, and then on VHS you would have them together. So they're tied together. They're not separate things. They should be presented together, but the DVDs don't do that. And then there's some other stuff missing. So yeah, I had to try to find a DVD that would replicate the VHS for me of Pokemon the first movie, and that had all of that stuff. So that's what I watched. I had to buy the DVD fucking twice, because the first DVD Amazon sent me had Pokemon 2000 in it. It didn't have Pokemon the first movie. And I was like, I guess I could tell Sean we're watching a different movie, but it really doesn't work if we're not doing the first movie. So I had to buy it twice, and I'll return one of these at some point. But yeah, so that's what I watched. I have a pretty high tolerance for the dub, because I think there's some good stuff in it. But this movie has an interesting history in Japanese, because the version that exists in Japanese now is not the original theatrical release version. In 98, the movie called Mewtwo Strikes Back came out in theaters in Japan. Then they went to work on the English dub presentation, and they actually reanimated some parts of the movie. And in Japan, they added a 10-minute prologue about Mewtwo's origin. And they added that to the movie. But then in America, they thought it was too dark, and they didn't put it on the theatrical print. But on DVD and VHS, there is a 3-minute cutdown of it. But this version of Mewtwo Strikes Back is called the Kanzenban release, the complete release of Mewtwo Strikes Back, and that's the version in Japan now. So that has its own convoluted history. But yes, we have the short Pikachu's Vacation, and then we have the full film, Mewtwo Strikes Back. And I'm really curious about what you found different. When you say the movie, do you mean Pikachu's Vacation, or do you mean the movie part itself?
Oh, no. Pikachu's Vacation is basically identical. I did mostly watch that in Japanese, mostly just because I found the music choices more acceptable in the Japanese version, because just a lot of the music has aged poorly, as most early 2000s, late 90s music kind of has. The Pikachu's Vacation, or Pikachu's Summer Vacation, as it is called in Japanese, that's basically almost completely identical, with the exception of some of the Pokemon voices. If they change a Pokemon's name, that means that they then have to change the performance. But if the Pokemon's name, like Pikachu or Mew, stays the same, then the voice is just whatever the Japanese voice is. So other than that, it's identical. There's no meaningful difference. The actual movie, Mewtwo Strikes Back, is noticeably very different between the two versions.
Yeah, so I've heard about this. We'll loop back around to Pikachu's Vacation then, because I'm so curious about this. Like, did the version you watch have the big 10-minute Mewtwo origin thing?
Yes, yeah.
Because that's weird short.
Because that's just sort of seamlessly integrated into the beginning of the movie. So the version you get if you watch, I guess the original Japanese version, or if you watch any English version, just sort of either starts with you get, if you have like the Mewtwo prologue thing for English, is you get like 2 minutes of whatever, the scientist walking through the woods or the jungle being like, and here's a Mew, the shrine of Mew, and I found his eyelash. And that's how we make Mewtwo. But then the movie really starts with a fully grown Mewtwo in the lab, being tested on. He wakes up, he explodes the lab, Giovanni shows up, all that shit. In the version I watched, which has the extra prologue on it, the movie starts with them finding the Mew's eyelash in the temple and using that to try to clone Mewtwo. But then it's about 10 minutes of Mewtwo as a small baby Mewtwo in a lab, with the scientist, and he has created an AI construct, like recreation of the mind of his dead daughter, I, who is now this AI construct is I2, and then there's a clone Squirtle, Charmander, and Bulbasaur, And all of them are in, like, the big, like, tanks, like you see the clones later in the movie being in. And they are all connected through, like, a kind of telepathic hive mind thing and are playing around inside of I2's memories. And Mewtwo and I2 become friends. But then eventually something goes wrong. Like, the cloning process is imperfect. And Squirtle, Charmander, and Bulbasaur slowly start disappearing. And then they disappear, and Mewtwo's just sort of floating there with I2 being like, what's going on, I? Like, what's happening? And then she's like, oh, I think our time is up. She starts slowly disappearing. Then she says, like, this really kind of poignant line that is the setup for what happens at the end of the movie, which is Mewtwo starts crying, and he's like, what is happening to me? Why is there water coming out of my eyes? And she says, those are tears, Mewtwo. And living creatures cry when they feel pain. And it's said that humans are the only animals that cry when they feel sad. And then she disappears. And then it cuts to... then they put Mewtwo into, like, a deep sleep because he starts freaking out. And they're like, oh, he's freaking out. Let's put him into his sleep. And then after he sleeps, he wakes up again years later, fully grown. And that's where the movie that we know, Pokemon, the first movie, starts.
And this whole prologue does exist in English. They held it back in 99 when they put this movie out, but there is a TV special called Mewtwo's Return that came out as a direct-to-video movie in the States. And on the DVD or VHS of that, it's called The Uncut Story of Mewtwo's Origin, and it's that whole 10-minute segment in English, and it does exist. But it was years later.
Yeah, and it really, like, it. The idea of watching this movie without that at the beginning is kind of strange to me now, because like the indie, like the only reference to tears in the movie happens there is none of the shit of like there's a ancient legend of that when Pokemon cry they get like none of that happens in the Japanese version at all.
Okay,
there's no reference to it until they cry at the end, so that's like the only piece that sets that up is at the very end of that little prologue bit.
Interesting. So okay, I'm just very curious about this. I liked watching the movie. I had fun with it. There's a point where the English dub goes off the fucking rails near the end, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
But what was your impression? Because I assume, like me, you probably have not seen a ton of Pokemon in Japanese. I think this is
the only Pokemon thing I've seen in Japanese, other than like a clip here and there of like a 30-second thing,
yeah,
I may have come across on the internet. This is the only sustained watching I've ever done of any Japanese Pokemon product.
So what did you think of it? What did you make of the movie?
I liked it quite a bit. Like, I think it's definitely pretty substantially better than the American movie. Most of the significant thematic complaints that I have about the American version of the movie do not really exist in the Japanese version. The ending is much, much fucking better. Mewtwo's a much more sort of complex, more interesting character. He's not trying to destroy the world with a giant typhoon or whatever the fuck he's trying to do in the English version. And then also just the general vocal performances are really strong. And in particular, so Team Rocket has always been the best part of the Pokemon cartoon.
Yes.
Anybody who knows anything knows that that's true. And I have a lot of love in my heart for English Team Rocket. So this is not putting English Team Rocket down, but Japanese Team Rocket is so fucking funny.
I agree, yes.
Their grasp of comedic timing is unbelievable. And there were multiple times in the movie where I actually laughed out loud because of... just like, because not because of big jokes, and I think this is one of the big differences. They are weirdly understated in the Japanese version. Whereas the English version, matching the like caliber of performances of everybody else, they're very over the top and cartoonish. In the Japanese version, they're like underplayed a lot. And there's something about that and their sense of like pacing with the timing. They're just really, really fucking funny. And that's where I kind of want to watch some early Japanese Pokemon, like some of the first few episodes, mostly just because I want some more of them.
Yeah.
Because they are fucking hilarious.
It's such a tragedy that Pokemon in Japanese is so hard to find, because I'd buy it if they just put out a Blu-ray with the... And I think there's a lot of people who would. I think the Pokemon company just likes to keep that iron curtain up between the two sides of the distribution. But yeah, I've heard Team Rocket in Japanese, and they are amazing. So yes, I agree with that. What else?
And there's also something that is very nice about having, like, all the voices sound like they come from the same place.
Yeah.
Which is to say, in English, you always have a couple of things like Pikachu that are very clearly performed by a Japanese performer, and like they just have a different quality to the sound. Like they feel like this Pikachu was recorded in one place at one time, in one part of the world with one like set of equipment and everything, and then Ash was recorded somewhere totally different a year later, with different equipment and different everything else. And so they never kind of like those two things never fully gelled. There's something nice about having all the Pokemon sounding similar and all the in like all the like the sort of the vocal soundscape of all the characters comes from the same spot. There's something that's very nice about that, and it's sort of it keeps everything on an even level. And one of the things that it does is it makes like I didn't have a problem with this when I was a kid, but watching Pokemon now, Pikachu just doesn't feel like it exists in the show in the same way that having Pikachu perform opposite Satoshi slash Ash in Japanese feels way more natural. And like this is not like a Pokemon and a human. These are two different characters that exist on the same level interacting with one another. That is much more convincing to me in the Japanese version.
I agree. I think I told the story. I watched some of the Sun and Moon anime in Japanese earlier this year, and it totally gave me that feeling. Yeah. Cause Rika Matsumoto, who plays Satoshi, and Ikue Otani have just very good chemistry, and like I assume they record together sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. Which Veronica Taylor, the original English Ash, obviously never did with Ikue Otani. That would be impossible. So yeah.
Yeah. And then the other thing, the MV fucking P of this movie is I need to look up his name because he's so, so good. Is the vocal performance of Mewtwo in Japanese is so cool. He is so, so fucking cool. And like English Mewtwo is no slouch. Like that's a pretty solid performance. Japanese Mewtwo is just on a different fucking level. It's Masachika Ichimura, who's not in a lot of stuff. Like, he's not a huge voice actor in Japan. He's not in, like, everything. But he just, kind of like with the Team Rocket thing, his performance is so subtle and understated and, like, kind of quiet in a way that's sort of unsettling because Mewtwo's character in this movie is not like particularly villainous, and most of the time it actually kind of reminds me of Broly from Dragon Ball Super Broly. Like, even though he's the character that the heroes are fighting against, you're mostly sympathizing with him because you understand why he's acting the way he is, because he suffered so much from the beginning of the movie and he doesn't have any place in this world, and he doesn't know who he is, what he wants to be. He feels like he's been pushed away by everything, and he's got this very sort of like childish quality to him, in him kind of lashing out this way. And a lot of that comes across both in sort of like a lot of the lines they have changed tremendously in the English version, but also that performance just sort of calibrates it in such a way that like I'm kind of rooting for Mewtwo in a lot of the sequences, just because I want him to be happy and for him to sort of like come to this point of realization of what he's doing is wrong, because once he realizes that, he'll be a happier person slash Pokemon. And a lot of that comes down to just how well played and well calibrated that performance is.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now I wish I had watched it in Japanese so I could talk with you about it, because I had a lot of fun with my little nostalgia trip last night, but this sounds really good. Cause I know just through osmosis and reading about it, that the biggest change in the story is that Mewtwo's motivations are different. That whole theme about Pokemon can't fight, not like this, that's not in Japanese. And then the ending's a little different. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So that's probably the most substantial actual change to the movie is that kind of there's the two elements that are sort of connected. Is one, in the English version, Mewtwo has several lines where he's basically saying, I'm going to take over the world. I'm going to, like, exterminate humanity.
He's
going to
kill all human and Pokemon. It's weirdly dark, yeah.
Yeah, and in Japanese, that's never his intention. You know, the one line he has early on that's very fucking cool, that sort of sets out sort of what his motivation is after he escapes from Giovanni, and this is before the big title drop that I think both of those come at the same moment where like the title card comes up. And he's sort of lands back on the island he's from, his helmet falls off. And in English, he has some line about how he's going to take over the world. In Japanese, he says this line that's like, that this is neither going to be an attack, nor is it a declaration of war. This is simply to all of you who have birthed me, this is a retaliation. This is where he says, like, this is like a counterattack, like, it's, or I'm going to strike back. It's the same line, Gyakshu, that is the Mewtwo strikes back, Mewtwo no Gyakshu. So he says that, and it's like, I'm going to retaliate, or I'm going to rebel against all you who have created me. And he flies off into the sky, and it's such a fucking mic drop moment. And then the title, like, Pocket Monster, the movie, Mewtwo strikes back, pops up on screen. It's like a fucking holy shit, that was a super cool, dope line. But that's sort of his thing, is that he wants to, one, he's constantly questioning, who am I, where am I, what am I doing, why am I here? He has this very sort of existentialist Frankenstein's monster quality to him. That's there a little bit in the English version, but it's much more emphasized in Japanese. So much so that the end of the movie, when everyone gets teleported back to the island and they lose their memory, and Ash says, where are we? That's a callback to and like a joke on Mewtwo's been asking that the whole movie. And then Ash says, where are we? I guess it doesn't matter, which is the answer to the question, which is the thematic resolution of the movie. So like there's that. So he has this existentialist quality to him. Then eventually he creates the island, summons everyone there to prove to himself that he is strong and like, and his life is worthwhile, because he has this sort of inferiority complex about being a clone. So that's why he creates all these clones, is to prove to himself and to everyone else that he is as worthwhile a like living creature as any Pokemon or any other human being. And he has this sort of inferiority complex because of he's born from Mew. And so that's really what his motivation is. It has nothing to do with killing people. He doesn't want to kill anybody. In fact, once he's proved his point, he has this really good line where he says, I have no interest in taking your lives. You can go back to the island if you can make it through that storm, I guess. And he gives this little smirk. So he doesn't want to take over the world or destroy anybody. He just wants to prove that he's powerful and that he like there is meaning in his life is really what he's out for. And that's a pretty substantial change from the way that the English movie handles it. The other thing is, yeah, that the fighting stuff at the end of, like, Pokemon aren't meant to fight, not like this, none of that, not a single fucking drop of that is in the Japanese movie. There's no reference to, like, Pokemon aren't meant to fight like this. The closest you get is that, because you obviously you have the scene where the Pokemon, the quote-unquote real Pokemon fight their clones, that's where all that happens. In Japanese, they contextualize that scene as Mewtwo's trying to prove that his Pokemon are the strongest. And so he wins the fight between like Charizard versus Charizard, Blastoise versus Blastoise, Venusaur versus Venusaur. He wins all of those fights. Then Mew comes down. All that shit happens with Mew. Then Mew has his like, Mew, 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 Mew that Meowth translates. In Japanese, when he translates that, what Mew is saying that if as long as they're the Pokemon are fighting and their bodies are clashing together and they're not throwing out moves. And since like, if it's not a Pokemon battle and it's just a brawl, the real ones will never lose against the fake ones is basically what Mew says.
Interesting.
And that's why all the Pokemon then start fighting and they're just beating the shit out of each other. And that's why it's so shocking to everybody is not because Pokemon aren't meant to fight blah, 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 blah. And like this isn't what we're supposed to be doing. It's that, these Pokemon are just beating each other to death. This isn't a Pokemon battle. This is like a Pokemon war. And that's more of the context that they give it is, and it's, there's no character trying to moralize it that way. The moralizing is more around, we shouldn't be fighting because we're all worthwhile. It doesn't matter if you're a real, quote unquote, real Pokemon or you're a clone. We're all living beings together. Why can't we just get along? That's like the moral message of the movie, not we shouldn't fight because fighting is bad. It's that we shouldn't fight because we're all equal. We're all living beings. Like whether we're Pokemon or we're human, whether we're like born or we're clones, we're all equal people and we shouldn't kill each other.
See, and I think the bones of this movie in Japanese or in English are pretty sturdy. I think this is a pretty good anime movie. And it sounds like they're much sturdier in Japanese. I think a lot of this shines through. You know, I think it's a well-animated movie. I like the structure. I like the pace. There's a lot of good character moments. There's some iconic stuff in there that's iconic for good reason. Mewtwo is still a really cool character in English, but I'm really now, like, salivating to see the Japanese film. You're going to have to tell me where you found it. I've had trouble finding some of this stuff in Japanese over the years. Maybe I'm just bad at it. But yeah, it's... it's interesting. I you know, we'll go through all of my different thoughts because I have just a lot of jokes to make about the dub because it is very cheesy at different moments, and I'm sure we can get into that. But it sounds pretty cool that because also I assume this movie has no weird pop music in it in Japanese.
No. Okay. There's like an insert song where the English Pokemon theme song happens at the beginning. There's a different song in Japanese, and then there's a different song that plays over the credits.
Okay.
But other than that, there are no insert songs.
Yeah, because there's a bunch of pop in this. They did... I will never understand why this was a thing, but back in the day, anime, whether it was Funimation, 4Kids, whoever, they always replaced the scores. So, like, Pokemon got a complete score replacement. Yu-Gi-Oh! Got a complete score replacement. Dragon Ball obviously did. And, like, without exception, when you hear the original music, it's not just that it's better. It's like, who would have objected to this? Like, Yu-Gi-Oh! Is actually the one that baffles me the most, because Yu-Gi-Oh! Has fucking cool music in Japanese. And I think if I were a kid, I would have thought that music was fucking cool. And, like, Dragon Ball, I can kind of understand it's a very different era of music style, and maybe kids wouldn't have been as into it. Pokemon always, to me, is also just baffling, because it's like, they're not that different. I think the Japanese is better, but, like, it's just music. Like, what the fuck are you guys doing? I almost wonder if there was, like, a licensing thing back in the day where, like, it was harder to license the music than the animation because they would just do these complete soundtrack replacements. But I don't think Pokemon had that problem because they still had Ikue Otani in there, whatever. But, yeah, so, like, it's very bizarre. You know, yeah, I was... Okay, this conversation is going in places I did not expect, Sean, because you sprung this on me. I thought we were going to have a fun time just, like, doing some a funny walk down nostalgia road. But this is actually quite substantive.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's what it was 100% pre-planned and not in any way a, like, desperate, oh God, like, just the quality of the voices in the English dub I find very grating. I just can't listen to Ash Ketchum talk for too long in a row, and it hurts me.
See, this is me with Dragon Ball in English. This is, like, that's my experience with pretty much all Dragon Ball in English. I can do it a little bit with the modern stuff. I cannot go back to anything pre, like, 2012. But, like... Pokemon, I just think because of the amount of time I was inundated with it, I'm okay, which makes me understand why, like, you don't have that same issue with Dragon Ball to that degree, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, different strokes, but I do get it. It's, you know, I think they did their best with what they had. There are some legitimately good performances in English. Obviously, Jesse James and Meowth were always great. But yeah, it's, you know, it was such a different approach to dubbing back then, you know? Because, like, the current Pokemon dub, I think it does some replacement music, but, like, it's a very literal dub. It doesn't change things. Even the qualities of the different vocal performances, they try to match very clearly. And so I don't think there's as much of a gap between them as there used to be. But yeah, in the 90s and early 2000s, it was just like they were trying to disguise that these things were even Japanese. You know?
Yes, yeah. I mean, that was literally the intent, was to make it seem as if this thing was produced in America. And yeah, to you know, change all the text on all the signs and everything, not for ones that are meaningful to the plot, but anything in the background that looked like it was written in Japanese, they tried to change it so that it looked English, because you want to throw in references to locations and things that people know and avoid any reference to foods or anything that would clearly mark it as being Japanese, which leads to some, like, funny instances where they would, like, actually replace things with, like, sushi with cheeseburgers or some bullshit translations.
They would, but Pokemon was even lazier about this, because I remember there are episodes of the anime where they are eating rice balls. Like, just Brock would make them rice balls, just the normal, simple Japanese dish of a rice ball, and they call them jelly donuts in English.
Yes.
Because they're so terrible. I mean... It's, like, virulently racist when you get down to it, like, now, and I think you look back at it. But, like, man, the difference between don't let the kids know this is Asian to now there's a popular Japanese streaming anime site called Crunchyroll. Like, we've come a long way, haven't we? But, okay. Do you want to talk about the movies themselves a little bit more now, though? And go through
let's get into it.
Let's talk about Pikachu's Vacation, because as you say, it's the same. It's just the Pokemon being Pokemon, right?
Yes, it's basically like what if we did a Looney Tunes short, but starring Pikachu instead of Bugs Bunny.
I love Pikachu's Vacation. I always liked the Pikachu shorts. I think they are just, it's what you said. It's like an anime, like more like an American animated short, like Looney Tunes or something like that. or even like Roadrunner or Tom and Jerry, something where there's no dialogue, you know, because it's all visual. It's all just pure visual inventiveness. And I think Pikachu's Vacation is really fun. It's 20 minutes. They're constantly throwing new ideas at you. It's very cute, but it is also just resolutely bizarre at points. Like Bulbasaur sings Togepi asleep with a lullaby, and I love that. Snubbull is leading a gang of bullies that includes Cubone and Meryl and Raichu. There's all those, as you say, the bizarre like 60s hippie transitions where like you have like Mankeys dancing, or there's the one with all the Magnemites that's very weird. At the end of the movie, you get Pikachu giving a big inspiring speech where Ikue Otani is just going Pika, Pika, Pikachu, Pika, Pika for like 30 seconds, and it's fantastic. I could watch this any day of the week. I have fun with this.
Yeah, like, it is something where, as you said earlier, Ash in Pokemon is, like, by far the least interesting thing in the show, and he's just a big dumb doofus. And I find his voice fairly grating in English now that I'm older, and it's only a little bit remedied in the Japanese version. Like, the Japanese performance of Satoshi is fine, but it's whatever. Like, the character is just a little bit dull. So if you can either have something that's just Team Rocket fucking around, or you can have something that's just Pikachu and other Pokemon getting into hijinks, that's the Pokemon cartoon at its best. And this is just 20 minutes of Pikachu and friends getting into hijinks, and that's very fun.
Yep. I mean, I had to tweet a picture of this. There's the scene where Charizard gets his head stuck in the hut, and they do this cutaway to Charizard inside, and he just starts crying like he thinks he's going to be in there forever. That is such a phenomenal illustration. It's so silly, but it's also like so weirdly heartfelt. I love that stuff. It's so goofy. And then they all have to come together to save Charizard. And Charizard is... I love that Charizard is like a badass who's like kind of aloof for most of this short. And then at the end, they have to save him because he got his fucking head stuck in a hut. And it's very fun.
My favorite part is when Pikachu and Raichu are just like racing across like the whole park with their cheeks pressed together. That part's very funny to me.
Yes. In English, you get a pop song at the beginning about being on vacation, and it's very funny, and I'm going to insert that here for a little bit so you can hear. I'm going to put in some of these pop songs because they are so silly. I think we would be robbing you if you did not get to hear excerpts of them. So let's listen to that for a second. Vacation, need a little sun to break up all the frustration and turn it into love. Ain't nobody gonna tell us what we gonna do, because today it's up to you. Temptation calling up for me, a little relaxation. I'll be there to come on a wicked, wicked loo. I think the lead is gonna start now. Kick it back, kick it back, kick it back to the track. Kick it back, kick it back, There's some good dialogue from the Pokedex in this, which I actually had to ask, does the Pokedex talk in the Japanese version?
No. I don't know if that's the case in the anime, like the TV show. In these movies, there's no instance where the Pokedex talks.
Okay.
The narrator is just this sort of generic, like, weird lady voice that sounds like she's like the... It's basically like the kind of voice you'd have in, like, Blue's Clues or something of, like... Where's the blah, 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 you know, it's like that, but it's a girl.
Okay.
That's the narrator.
Because you do have Pokedex in here, and there's one line with this really on-the-nose character exposition where this is when they're all trying to get Charizard out and Cubone won't help. The Pokedex says, Cubone has earned its classification as the lonely Pokemon because of its usual attitude of only caring about itself. And I had to type that out because it is such a amazingly on-the-nose piece of character exposition, and I also just wrote in my notes, I guarantee you that's only in the dub.
Yeah, no, that is nothing about that is... I don't even know... I don't think the narrator even says anything at that point. The narrator in the Japanese version is like... has a couple of lines, but it's very sparse.
No, I have a pretty good radar at this point in my life of when the dub team is furiously adding stuff between actual lines of dialogue, and that's just the way like that shot is composed and the length of the edit. I'm like, yeah, no one's talking here in Japanese. I guarantee you. So yeah, but Pikachu's Vacation, like I love all of these. There's Pikachu's Rescue Adventure on Pokemon 2000. That one's okay. Pikachu and Pichu in Pokemon 3 is a lot of fun, and that is one that you cannot see in Japanese anymore, unless you torrent it, I assume, because the narrator of the Pokemon 3 short was arrested for drugs, and they have erased that short from existence in Japan. So
there you go.
Yeah. But there were some fun ones of these back in the day. Anything else to say about Pikachu's Vacation?
It's just a good time. It's just fun. Yep. You know, that's like, I'm not sure if I would recommend, even like, you know, I was talking about how the Japanese version of Pokemon, the first movie, is better than the English version. I don't want to give the impression that that means I think it's like an amazing movie and that people should go out of their way to see it. It's more of like a fun curiosity. If you have an affection and nostalgia for Pokemon and you just want a little bit of a buzz, then you should watch Pikachu's Vacation, because it's just a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
It's good, good, happy time.
It's why I'm so kind of offended by them not putting these out anymore. Because, one, they were just, they were part of the experience. Because this is a 70-minute movie in English. It's longer in Japanese. But, like, if you went to see a 70-minute movie in theaters, you'd be pretty pissed off. So they add this 20-minute short, so it feels like a full feature-length runtime. And, yeah, you gotta have Pikachu's Vacation. It's just, it's the best part. All right, then we get into the actual movie. The opening of this in English is so goofy, and I love it. It opens with, like, images of rivers and trees, and there's this, like, image of a river, and the tree, and, like, the river is, like the waves are wafting over it kind of softly, and there's a tree reflected in the river, and then the narrator comes in and says, "Life, the great miracle, and the great mystery." And I need to do the video where I put this together with the beginning of Terrence Malick's The New World, because it is weirdly similar, and I think it is... I did not remember that the Pokemon movie got off to such an existential start. It's very bizarre.
I do not think any of that narration is in the Japanese version.
Probably not. Like, he goes on and on about, like, how life, it's a mystery, it's a miracle, it's dumb. Let's see. Brock starts sexually harassing women as soon as he sees them in hologram form at the beginning of this movie. Is Brock that perverted in Japanese?
I mean, he still is, like, every time he sees a lady, he's like, oh, she's very cute or she's very pretty. But at least in this movie, it feels less... I think it's mostly, like, the performance is not as cartoonish, so it's not as grating.
Yeah.
It's not as much like a... Because I feel like the way the English version is calibrated, he might as well have, like the eyes popping out of his jaw, hit the ground, like, oh, God, like do the full-on Looney Tunes kind of thing. He's not quite like that in Japanese, but every time he sees a lady, he's like, oh, that's a cute lady.
Okay, yeah. And that's also something that you can probably modulate differently in Japanese than in English. There's something about the way Brock is voiced as, like, this full-grown man walking around with these kids constantly hitting on women when they don't... constantly making unwanted advances on women that, like, as an adult, I watch that and I'm like, this would not fly today. It is. Brock's a perv.
Yeah, he's just a bit more soft-spoken, like, which is true across the board of basically every single performance in Japanese for Pokemon. It's like, they're just more soft-spoken and less like a, hey, guys, which is more the, like... kids cartoon English voice thing we do.
Yep. Okay, so my favorite thing in the Pokemon the first movie dub is that, so the plot, if you haven't seen this movie in a while, is that it opens with, there's all the stuff with Mewtwo, which you went over earlier, and it's basically the same in English at the beginning, other than that 10-minute prologue is not there, and then at the end he decides he's going to take over the world, not just look for his place in it, you know, which is a different motivation. And then you get Ash and Misty and Brock are all hanging out, and Brock is making soup, and Ash is hungry because he's a putz. And then a trainer challenges Ash, and we have the opening credits over their battle scene. And that's a fun opening to the movie. It's actually a pretty cool Pokemon battle, I think. You can tell the animation is stepped up a little bit from the show. So
yeah, one note about the dude that comes to duel him at the beginning in Japanese is that I think that the character is literally actually voiced by a foreigner, because his performance is very well done. But it is a character that, like, speaks English that's like a, hey, man, come on, Pokemon battle, shinai? And he, like, pulls out a Pokemon. It's like, so he's, like, sort of speaking Japanglish or however you want to do that. Like, he's trying to communicate in Japanese, but it's clearly an English person. And it's a very well-calibrated performance. Again, I think it maybe is actually a foreigner. And I found it very surprising, because I was not expecting that voice to come out of that dude, but also very funny.
That's awesome. Okay, so we have that guy, we have that. And then in the English version, we get our first pop song of the movie. Well, like, third if you count Pikachu's Vacation. But we have the cover of the Pokemon theme song, which we've always loved. The English Pokemon theme song is great. And this cover is pretty good. I played it as our theme song this week. So that's there. It's kind of funny. You get that fight. And then they get this message from Mewtwo. They don't know it's Mewtwo yet. Inviting them to this island where he's collecting all these trainers. Is that basically what Mewtwo's doing in Japanese too?
Yeah, he's collecting all the trainers to come to his island and giving them the test of the typhoon or whatever, so to get the strongest one so he can prove his own strength.
Interesting. I also have to note, there are 2 points in this movie that prove my theory that Ash's Pikachu is just the strongest Pokemon in existence. First, in the Pokemon battle at the beginning, that dickhead trainer, who I guess is foreign in Japanese, just throws out like 4 Pokemon at the end, which is a clear violation of the rules, and Pikachu just does 1 Thunderbolt and kills all of them.
One of them being a golem, yes, which is rock type, and so it's like, shouldn't have fucking worked. That movie should not have worked at all.
And Pikachu's very strong. And then later in the movie, when all the other Pokemon are being abducted by Mewtwo's floating balls, that sounded wrong. That came out wrong.
Yeah, his floating monster balls. Yes, yeah.
By Mewtwo's floating monster balls, Pikachu runs away the longest, and he just keeps electrocuting them all away. It's a pretty badass sequence. I think Pikachu just, especially now, after 20 years of being trained and not evolving, Pikachu is clearly the strongest Pokemon.
I mean, why do you think Team Rocket wants Pikachu so bad? It's because Pikachu's the best Pokemon.
Yes. Really wasted on a putz like Ash, but oh well. Anyway, so I forget what I was...
Yeah, literally any other trainer would have become, like, the Pokemon Grandmaster at this point with Pikachu.
Yes.
It's just because Ash sucks so hard that he still has not managed it after, like, 20 fucking years.
Yes. Okay. In the English version, they go to this town, and they're going to go on the ferry and go over to Mewtwo's place, right? And there's a big storm. Yes. And there's actually a scene I really love where Mewtwo, the way it's shot is like Mewtwo is in the chair, and it's framed behind him, and he's got his hand, which has the three little orbs, and he's just whirling it. And it's like he's conducting this storm. It's very musical. It's a great piece of animation. I really love that.
Yeah, it's very awesome. Most of the, like, anything in this movie where Mewtwo is being very cool holds up whichever version you're watching. Because Mewtwo is just very cool, and he's a good character design, and he's animated well. And his weird, like, island castle is very awesome. Like, everything to do with that side of the movie is just good, whichever version you're watching.
It's a very well-designed and animated movie, I think.
Yeah.
Like, I was going back through some of the reviews at the time, and critics hated these movies, obviously. And one of the things they would always say, and you often get this about anime from critics, especially in the 90s and early 2000s, is they say it's ugly. And it's because they've never seen anime before, and it doesn't look like American animation. This is not an ugly movie. Like, I get if you're holding it up next to, I don't know, what was coming out in 2000? Not Shrek. Shrek is an ugly fucking movie. But, you know, something better than Shrek. I could see that it's a different kind of animation, but obviously today, like, you hold this up to other anime, it's not One Punch Man or something, but it looks good.
Yeah, and I mean, it's also, it's not like a Ghibli film.
No.
It's not like Ghost in the Shell. Like, it's not like an astoundingly animated feature film.
Yeah.
But it is good. Like, it's well animated.
Yeah.
It looks nice. It's like, the framing is good. Like, it looks like a movie version of Pokemon.
Yes. So, okay, so we've got all that, but they get to this place where they're going to go on the ferry, and everyone's warning them, you can't go out in the rain, and then you get my favorite character in the English version, which is this weird Russian lady who is hanging out with Officer Jenny, because, like, remember, dubs in the early 2000s and late 90s loved accents. No one knows why. No one ever knew why. Why was Jace Australian in Dragon Ball Z? We're never going to find out. Why is Meowth from Brooklyn? Who knows? They at least pulled that off in Pokemon. Meowth being from Brooklyn is funny. But, like, yes, you have a lot of accents, and in this one you have this weird Russian lady who says lines like... So she gives this whole prophecy about Pokemon tears, and you get this line that is so fucking great, where she goes, "But there are no Pokemon tears today, just waters, which no one can survive." And that line, Sean, it's like she's reading out of, like, a Dostoevsky ripoff. It's fucking great.
Yeah, that character is not like that in Japanese.
Of course not.
As you might guess. One, definitely not Russian. Like, it's just a normal performance. And she mostly, I forget, she has a weird name. It's like Navigator or something in Japanese. But she, like, she's just basically there being like, hey, you can't, like, I think she's the mayor of that town or whatever.
That makes more sense.
And she just says, you can't leave. I've lived here my whole life and I've never seen a storm this bad. You can't go. And that's basically her whole role. Again, there is nothing in the Japanese version at all about some sort of prophecy that Pokemon tears can bring people back to life. that is completely manufactured for the English version, which was maybe one of the more surprising changes, was that that's just completely excised, because I remember that very distinctly as being a core plot mechanic of the movie, is that Pokemon Tears can bring people back to life.
Yes, but Sean, like, that line sounds like something Vladimir Putin would say in a war declaration. Uh-huh. But there are no Pokemon Tears today. Just waters, which no one can survive. And then she has this line when they're all leaving without, like, they're leaving without the boats, and Ash is getting on the boat with Team Rocket, and she says, "Some trainers have no fear. To them, this is just one more challenge. They follow their hearts. This is what sets them apart, and will make them Pokemon Masters." I want a spinoff about random Russian Pokemon philosopher lady. Where's her fucking movie?
To be fair, that second line is pretty close to what she says in Japanese. Because in Japanese, it is like a, like, they, you know, I, yeah, they're Pokemon trainers and they're adventurers and they're always going to go out and
yes, but in Japanese, she's not doing it with a cool cool Russian accent, and it's not silly as hell.
She's just speaking. She's just a speaking person.
All right, then you have in English Jesse and James from Teen Rocket pretending to be Vikings. They're kind of dressed like Vikings. Is that at all what they're doing in Japanese?
I mean, they're dressed like Vikings, but they don't do... Like Musashi or slash Jesse is disguising her voice a little bit, but she's not doing a, like, a, "Oh, I'm a Viking." She's not doing that.
Yeah. But you do get here the weirdest... In English, you get the weirdest joke in the history of Pokemon. Which is,
yes, the one place where the English version surpasses the Japanese version is in this one line.
Which is, Brock says, "I didn't know Vikings still existed." And Ash replies, "They mostly live in Minnesota." I have so many questions about this line, Sean. They mostly live
it's
in
so
Minnesota.
Weird.
It's so weird. I mean, okay, so it's a Minnesota Vikings reference, which already, who is that for? I don't know. How does Minnesota exist in the world of Pokemon?
And how does Ash know about it? And what is Ash's life that Minnesota exists, the Minnesota Vikings exist, and Ash is such a dweeb that he thinks that the Minnesota Vikings are actual literal Vikings that he just happened to run into on this weird coastal city.
The Pokemon anime did not do this a lot, but it would occasionally just make clear references to American geography in a way that, if you think about it for a second, breaks down the continuity of Pokemon so hard there's nothing left. My other favorite example of this is in the episode Meowth Goes West or something like that. It's the Meowth origin story episode, which is a really great episode of Pokemon. They make references to going to Hollywood. And, like, all the characters go to Hollywood together. And they're not. They're just going to a random Pokemon town. And in Japanese, I'm sure it's just some made-up town name. Because every Pokemon town has some made-up name, right?
Yeah.
And the whole story is that Meowth was corrupted by Hollywood. And, like, I love the idea that, like, in the world of Pokemon, there still exists the United States of America, which means all the implications of the United States existing exist in the world. There was a fucking Pokemon Vietnam at some point. And, like, that means that there's a Hollywood making movies, and Meowth went there and got corrupted, and also Ash has been to Hollywood. It's still not as weird as the fucking Minnesota Vikings joke, but it's fucking weird.
Yeah, it's just one of those... There are the unintended consequences of extreme localization. Very funny.
All right.
Oh, that light is so good.
I got to recommend another song for you guys that we're going to have to spice in here for a second, which is that when you get the big fight scene near the end of the movie where all the Pokemon are fighting each other, you get this really cheesy indie rock song called Brother My Brother. So let's listen to that for a second.
My brother, tell me, what are we fighting for? We got to end this war. We should love one another. Oh, can't we just pretend this war never began? We can try. Brother, my brother.
And it's like this one dude on, like, an acoustic guitar singing about how bad it is to fight. And he's like, we've got to end this war. Tell me what we're fighting for. And like, this is also the scene where you've got all the clones, like, fighting. And I assume in Japanese it's a fairly harrowing sequence because it's about, like, man, these Pokemon are really beating each other up. In English, because of that song and because of the added theme about how Pokemon shouldn't fight, it's just fucking goofy. I mean, this is where you get the gif of Pikachu slapping Pikachu, which in context is like 30 seconds of the movie. It goes on forever. I think part of why it's become so memed is where it is presented in English, you know?
Yeah, like, because it is like a, it's like a weirdly shocking scene in the Japanese version. I think because of that additional context of Mew's just kind of like a no, like the real ones, if we just fucking fight it out, the real ones are definitely going to win. And then they all just start beating the shit out of each other. And then like directly juxtaposing, this is what a Pokemon battle is like. This is what a Pokemon battle is like, son. And yeah, and then, you know, then there's some like Pikachu that's like, I don't want to fight. And the other Pikachu's just slapping Pikachu in the face. I love the two Meowths have this really great conversation where they're just like, oh, like these claws hurt. Like, oh, your claws probably hurt more than mine. And they like, because neither of them want to fight. And then they both sit down and stare up at the moon. And other Meowth is just like, the moon sure is round tonight. And our Meowth is like, yes, yes, it is. It's, and it's just, it's weirdly poetic in like a weirdly touching way that's like, oh.
I like this scene in English too. It's not poetic. It's very different. And they have Meowth English do all the talking and everything.
Yeah.
And it's, let me read some of the dialogue here because it's kind of funny. It's also just well delivered. But she goes, or Meowth goes, you mean we don't have to fight with each other? But how can I trust you? You was born different. Which I love that line. I like, that's like racism in like, how can I trust you? You was born different. And then he goes, you know what? You're right. We do have a lot in common. Now I'm doing Cockney. I'm not going to do the accent.
Yeah.
We do have a lot in common. The same earth, the same air, the same sky. They're like looking up at it together. So it's clearly like inspired by the Japanese. But you've got that sappy writing plus Meowth's crazy Brooklyn voice. I'm laughing very hard. I love it.
Yeah. It's not a particularly funny scene in the Japanese version. But it's iconic for a reason.
Yeah, I gotta give props, by the way, to the original voice of Meowth in English was a woman named Maddie Blaustein. I always thought she was the best performance in the original Pokemon dub. English Meowth is awesome. She died really young. She died, I think, like she was like 47, and it was right after they made the changeover in casts when Pokemon Company International took over. She was also one of the first trans women to be a major voice actor on something like this. She was also an activist for trans women in the arts. And also just, I think, a really good voice actor. Because I think you can tell in the Pokemon dub who's a good voice actor and who is kind of slumming it in the Pokemon show. Mm-hmm. And I think she's one of the like really talented ones. Like, I assume she would still be doing dubs and stuff if she were alive, which a lot of the Pokemon cast is not, because I, you know, they were kind of a different era. And I was looking that all up last night, and cool life story and everything too. So I missed that Meowth.
Definitely.
But then you've got, this is what I mean when I say the dub goes off the rails, is when you've got Pokemon aren't meant to fight, not like this. Why can't Mewtwo figure out it's wrong to make Pokemon fight this way? And the best one is Brock and Misty have an exchange where Brock says, those Pokemon are ready to fight to the death. And Misty says, that's a fight nobody will win. Which, they're going to fight to the death. That's a fight nobody will win. You think, Misty?
Yeah. Yeah, that entire conversation in Japanese is the one where they're having about, like, but they're both living things. And, like, the characters are grappling with the idea of, like, does life hold the same value when it's been created artificially as when it's, you know, been born organically? And I think it's actually Nurse Joy is the one that's like, no, all living things are just living things. Then we should have peace.
It's, I mean, where did this come from? Like, I don't know how you can reasonably be the people making Pokemon in English and know that this is all based on a video game series where Pokemon fight, and that is the core mechanic, is Pokemon battles. The core thing about the show is Ash Ketchum is going from town to town trying to become a Pokemon master by fighting with his fucking Pokemon, and you're going to make the point of Pokemon the first movie, you're going to try to alter it so the theme is it's like a fucking weird anti-war movie, and like there shouldn't be fighting. And then like, you know, we always make the jokes about the morality of Pokemon, like, oh, it's like dogfighting, ha ha ha. But like, there's an internal continuity to the show that like addresses this, and like, you know, you don't really have to worry about it, except when you have a line like Pokemon aren't meant to fight, not like this. Then it's like, well, what kind of weird shades of gray moralism are you doing here, lady, where like it's okay for Pokemon to fight sometimes, it's not okay for them to fight like this? That's just, that's such a weird line, and it makes you think of the morality of Pokemon in a way you shouldn't have to think about.
Yeah, and I think it mostly seems to come from this need in the localization to sort of sand down the more complex sort of existentialist themes that the movie, like, which again, like, me saying that, I don't want to present it like the Japanese version of the movie is some sort of like Nier Automata level of like complex discourse on existentialism. Like, that's not what I'm saying. But it has kind of like with the Digimon cartoon, there's a certain like sort of interest in tackling a more abstract thematic topic at the heart of the movie that the English version just thinks that the kids are not going to get or be interested in. So they just sort of pluck it out a little bit, dial Mewtwo's villainy up to 11 and have him not just want to figure out why he exists, but for him to destroy all the planet and conquer it in the process. And then, yeah, when you have this big conflict at the end of the movie, the issue is that the conflict exists at all, and that it's like, we shouldn't fighting is just bad, we should not be the fighting, and that, you know, is not necessarily like, you know, I think pacifism is a totally fine thing for a kids show to preach. I think that the show should not, preaching pacifism should not have at its core conceit that the main character goes around and fights people as, like, the structure for every single episode.
I mean, that would be like if you took a fucking Dragon Ball Z movie and the dub had that line, where, like, Broly is beating them all up and Bulma is
Saiyans aren't meant to fight, not like this. Jesus is like, yes, we are, women. We're literally the fighting race. That's what we called, we're a race of warriors. It's like, no, but you don't get it. Like, Frieza shouldn't make Saiyans fight.
Yeah, it's
not like this. It's wrong.
Not like this, indeed. And then the climax of the movie is where Ash becomes Pokemon Jesus. He dies for their sins. He takes the blast from you. He is resurrected by their tears. It's so crazy. I kind of love it. Is it? What is it in Japanese? Like, how is it different?
So, this is still, I think, by far the roughest part of the movie. I think the climax and, like, resolution of the movie is just rushed. But one thing that's very interesting is, because the English version three or four times across the movie seeds this story of when the Pokemon tears can bring people back to life, that makes it so that Ash getting hit by those blasts and being petrified in the English version explicitly is implied that he is dead.
Yes.
And so he's being resurrected. In the Japanese version, because you don't have that story, it's not explicitly that he's dead. He just seems to be petrified and, like, you know, some sort of spell is over him. And he, like, literally freezes into stone, and Pikachu's trying to revive him, which is still, that still hits me pretty hard when Pikachu's shocking Ash on the ground.
Yeah, that
scene hits me.
I had forgotten that moment where Pikachu keeps electrocuting Ash. That's maybe the best scene in the movie, and it's because Ikue Otani, her performance there is out of this fucking world of, like, the way she's doing all the Pikas to, like, represent Pikachu's, like, horror and grief here. It's surprisingly emotional.
Yeah, and then Pikachu starts crying, yeah, and, like, this big close-up right on Pikachu's face. Like, you can't, if you don't get affected by that and you're not, like, tearing up a little bit, you're not a fucking human being.
Yeah.
You're a living creature that can only cry when you feel physical pain, not a human that cries when you feel sadness. But yeah, so in the Japanese version, the context for that scene just comes from that line at the beginning of the movie about that humans are the only animals that cry because they feel sad. So it's more implied that Ash is just sort of petrified, not necessarily that he is dead and is being resurrected. But there is no direct explanation for the, like, the physical mechanics of how Pokemon tears bring Ash back to life, because obviously, like, all that footage is the footage.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's all the Pokemon start crying and the tears coalesce on Ash and he is, like, cured and he stands up and he's like, what the fuck just happened? And Mewtwo's like, oh my god. the power of...
Yeah, that sounds like it's a lot more poignant in Japanese, because what the moment is doing in Japanese is for Mewtwo showing him the value of this relationship between Pokemon and people, and like also just the value of life in a way that is so much more literalized in English that, and it's also tying back to Mewtwo's story with this like girl he loved. It makes it more of Mewtwo's story, which I think is what the movie wants to be.
Yes, no, so it is, while like I do think it still stretches the realm of like, or like the your suspension of disbelief to have it happen, because there's no real setup for how that can physically happen, it works much better because it's not necessarily set up in a plot mechanic way, which is what the English version is very concerned with, is the English version needs to plant all these seeds for how does this physically occur? Oh, we have to create this legend and all this stuff. Whereas the Japanese version just kind of doesn't give a shit on why that is able to bring Ash back to life. It just more cares about it making the final thematic point, which is that all life, Pokemon and human, is worthwhile. And Mewtwo is making a mistake in undervaluing himself in thinking that because he is artificially made that he is inherently different, when Mewtwo is capable of feeling the same kind of sadness as all these Pokemon are feeling, and therefore all this life is as valuable as all the other life forms. And that's like, it's much more about making that thematic point at the end, and that element of it lands. Again, this is not Citizen Kane, this is not the best movie ever.
It doesn't have to be, like, it's a Pokemon movie.
Yeah. But it's competent in this like structural way that's like I found very shocking, because I was not expecting the movie to be able to make that scene work for me on that level, because the English movie, that scene is just the most like, oh my god, this is just the most saccharine fucking horse shit. All the Pokemon cry and Ash is resurrected from the fucking dead. It's very dumb in the English version. Whereas it's like, this is a kid's movie and it's a bit silly, but like it's therefore, it's making a point.
But this also, having the scene here. This also sounds to me like it would, because I agree the ending feels a little rushed, that Mewtwo kind of flies off right away. In Japanese, though, if it's that connection to his own past and like the way it thematically works, it makes more sense why he wraps everything up the way he does then. Like, I agree that it would land more because it ties it to Mewtwo, not to Ash. I feel like the dub tries to retrofit Ash as the protagonist, but Ash isn't the protagonist of this movie. This is kind of like, you've talked about with Infinity War, Avengers, where Thanos is arguably the protagonist of that. Mewtwo's the protagonist of Mewtwo Strikes Back. Like, it's his story.
Absolutely, yeah, 100%. And the Japanese version definitely puts that way more front and center. Especially when, like, the first 20 fucking minutes. Because if you have that whole prologue, Ash doesn't show up into the movie until like 25 minutes in.
Yeah.
So it's a big stretch of the movie before you have Ash show up, which is one of the reasons why I suspect the English version didn't want to do that, was they thought it's just, that's way too long before you have our main character show up. Not realizing that, no, your main character shows up like 2 minutes in, because the main character is Mewtwo, and he's cute when it's a little baby Mewtwo.
Well, this is what I was talking about earlier. This is the mode Pokemon works for me most often in, is when it's not so much about Ash, but it is this anthology thing where, like, Ash is the character that gets us places, but it's other people's stories. And those can be really good. Like, Pokemon 3, which I also picked up on DVD because it was cheap and I like this one. Pokemon 3 is really good, and it's another one that is, like, Ash is in it, and I actually think it's a good use of Ash, but the story is about this little girl who's lost her mom, and then her dad dies, and Entei shows up, and Entei kidnaps Ash's mom to try to give this little girl her own mom, and Ash has to rescue his mother, but it is the little girl's story. Like, I think Pokemon as, like, the story of, like, this big world where we meet all these different people and see different stories, that's where Pokemon is at its best, and Ash is just our vessel to get us to those places, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, in English, though, Ash fucking dies, he experiences death, he comes back as the Pokemon Messiah. I feel like it's weird that that is not brought up in every subsequent episode of the show. Like, Brock and Misty should have each gone off and written a gospel. Ash becomes, like, some kind of god figure to Pokemon. I know they have their minds wiped at the end, but, I just think, like, that should be... Like, Ash should not get over that so quickly. He saw the other side, and he came back. He died for their sins.
He is the Pokemon Jesus.
Yeah.
Like, the problem is, like, he has to actually, like our Jesus, he has to actually die for good before you can create, like, a whole religion around him. Because if he's just walking around, it would just be a bit self-serving if he made his own religion, you know?
Yeah. Mewtwo's final line in the movie in English, "I see now that the circumstances of one's birth are irrelevant. It is what you do with the gift of life that determines who you are." Mewtwo gets pretty fucking woke. 70 minutes.
Yep.
And that honestly, that is not that out of line with what he's talking about in Japanese, it sounds like.
No, yeah, I don't remember specifically what he talked about at the very end. Yeah. But yes, it's something along those sorts of lines.
But yeah, Mewtwo's a good character. I love Mewtwo. There should be more Mewtwo stuff in Pokemon, because he's cool. There's the Mewtwo Returns special. That one's okay. It's not as good.
Yeah, I kind of want to watch that now, mostly...
In Japanese.
Obviously, the Japanese version, mostly because that fucking performance of Mewtwo is just so fucking cool.
Yeah, I want to find this
Mewtwo's just very sexy in Japanese. Like, there's something about him that's just like a... If this was the Mewtwo that we got in, like, 2019, like, fuck The Shape of Water. Like, people would be all over Mewtwo. He's such a sexy monster boy. Like, it's so good.
I didn't think that's where we were headed, but that's where we are. Sean, in English, the film closes. So it's got the credits, which I actually really love, the animated credits and watching all. There's some really nice images in there. In English, they fit in 5 different pop songs.
Right, I forgot about this. Yeah.
They keep cutting to different pop songs. They have 5 of them. Because this movie, this is not a thing anymore. But back in the 90s and 2000s, movies always had tie-in soundtracks, and it would be the ones where they say music from and inspired by the motion picture, right? Like, yeah. Spider-Man had this, Batman had this, and Pokemon for movies 1, 2, 3 had these, and they were like big productions. I mean, Christina Aguilera sings over the credits of Pokemon the first movie, which is fucking weird when I say that sentence today, right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
But this was like one of the big merchandising things, and that soundtrack, I was going through it earlier, so there's songs that are in the movie, like some of the ones I've played for you so far. That soundtrack also has some that are just the inspired by songs that are extra tracks to fill out the track listing. Sean, did you know, I kept this off of your outline as a surprise, Billy Piper from Doctor Who, Rose Tyler, the first companion of modern Doctor Who, before she was an actress, she was a pop star. She has a song on the soundtrack of Pokemon the first movie. It's called Making My Way, parentheses, any way that I can, and it is exactly what you think it is. Let's listen. So yes, Rose Tyler sings on the soundtrack for the Pokemon movie, and I feel like we've hit some kind of nexus between all of our different topics on this show, Sean.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Ikue Otani is Pikachu and also Morgana from Persona 5, so we can wrap that one in there.
We've got Doctor Who and Pokemon.
Yep, we got Doctor Who, Pokemon, Persona. Here, I've got another one for you. We can wrap some Dragon Ball in here. Because Jonathan, there are 2 voices that I was very surprised to hear in the Japanese version. I was not expecting. One is that Giovanni, the last gym leader who's also the leader of Team Rocket, is in Japanese voiced by Hirotaka Suzuoki, who is from Dragon Ball. Yes, he's the original voice of Tenshinhan. He passed away in the early 2000s. He is also the voice of Captain Bright Noah from Gundam. He's one of like the main Gundam characters in a bunch of those shows. He's also the Dragon Shiryu from Saint Seiya. I mentioned those roles because one of the bit roles in the movie, it's the trainer that has the Pidgeot that is on Mewtwo's island.
That they accidentally call Pidgeotto in the English dub.
Yes, none of that. That's not it. They don't fuck up Pokemon names of the Japanese.
They do it a bunch in this movie. Team Rocket says a. Caesar, no, not Caesar. What's Scyther, I think.
Scyther.
They call him Alakazam.
Which is bad, yeah. Yes. But anyways, that Pokemon trainer is in Japanese voiced by Toru Furuya.
Oh my god, Yamcha!
Yamcha in Dragon Ball. also Amuro from Gundam and Seiya from Saint Seiya. And it's just, I feel like there was some sort of blood pact made between Toru Furuya and Hirotaka Suzuoki that they just had to be in everything together. They're both also in fucking Detective Conan. They're in everything. Every fucking role they have, they are together, and they're both main characters. And it blew my mind because Giovanni shows up at the beginning of the movie, and I'm like, oh my god, that's Captain Bright, that's Tichino, that's Suzuki. And then later in the movie, the fucking dude with the Pidgeot shows up, and he says a couple of lines, he's like, is that Toru Furuya? And then he ends some sentence with the Japanese particle Zay, and he says it in a very Amuro way, and I'm like, oh my god, that's Toru Furuya. What is going on? He's not even... Because I don't think any of the other bit trainers are played by, like, notable voice actors. It's just him.
Those are two heavy hitters, yeah.
Yeah, this movie came out in the 90s. He had been Amuro in Yamcha for 20 fucking years by the time this movie came out. It's like, why is he in this?
I know, I have not seen it, but I heard in the most recent Pokemon movie 21, The Power of Us, Masako Nozawa is in that. In a
badass,
fairly major role. Masako Nozawa very rarely plays characters outside of Goku these days. But I think that was her first appearance on Pokemon, which is kind of wild when you think about it, how long Pokemon's been around, that they only just now got her. It kind of makes me want to see that movie just for her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. This conversation went to some unexpected places. I had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah. Again, there's a part of me that just wants to watch some more Pokemon stuff in Japanese because... Team Rocket. Oh my god, when in the middle part of the movie, when we're talking about like the Scyther Alakazam bit, you know, they're doing the bit of the like the who's that Pokemon? And they're doing it in English and it's fine in English. In Japanese, it's the same bit, and I have no connection to that the Japanese side of where it's Ano Pokemon wa da 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 Pikachu. Like it's the same kind of pacing, the same thing. I have no connection to that. I've never seen that in the Japanese version of the show. The delivery they have is so fucking perfect, and the pacing of it is so good. The first time they did it, I lost my shit. And when I watched it again in the English version, it's like, it's fine in English, but they don't, like, the pause is like, it's like, to the fucking millisecond, the perfect length. And every single time they do it, when it comes, the bit comes up again, they do it the exact same way, and they're basically just breaking the fourth wall, but in a way that is so fucking razor sharp precise. It's so funny. Like, people who have not seen Japanese Pokemon just need to at least find some, like, clips on YouTube or something. Because Japanese Team Rocket is fucking hilarious.
Well, now I've got to watch this fucking movie again in Japanese. I've got to return one of these two DVDs because they sent me the wrong movie. I'm having a Pokemon party over here. And next week we get to see Detective Pikachu. I'm actually, I got to say, Detective Pikachu comes out. It'll be Thursday night. And I have to turn in my final paper for the semester Thursday afternoon. And that'll be a great way to unwind. I'm really looking forward to Detective Pikachu being the symbol that I am done with the semester. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, there's maybe no more fitting movie than Detective Pikachu to just sign out on that semester with.
Yes, yes, absolutely. But I think we're going to talk about it on the podcast next week, hopefully. I don't know if I'll be in town yet or not for us to do it in person, but we'll figure it out. It'll happen one way or another. And, yeah, we're going to keep this Pokemon train a-rolling. And then the week after that, we got John Wick 3. I mean, we got some good stuff coming up, Sean.
There's a lot of movies coming out. Now I just have to find out how I can find just a web phone camera rip of the Japanese version of Detective Pikachu. Because apparently that's just fucking my life.
It might be. I have to say, there were some clips of this today. Japanese Detective Pikachu is not as good as you think it is. They did not get a particularly interesting actor for Pikachu. They tried to do, like, they didn't get a voice actor. They did kind of the Ryan Reynolds route where they got a live-action star who's kind of popular, but he's like this young idol guy. He's not as funny as Ryan Reynolds. It doesn't sound as good. I've actually heard there's some complaints from Japanese audiences that they wish the dub was better.
That's unfortunate. Yeah. Because... I mean, all they needed to do is go up to Ikue Otani and just be like, hey, you want to fucking do this? And she would fucking do it.
Or if you've played the game Detective Pikachu, the Japanese Pikachu in that is awesome. Like, just have that guy do it. But they didn't. Oh, well.
Again, just Ikue Otani. She is everything. She is Pikachu. Just let her fucking do it.